Bonjour, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 380. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me, as always, are Guillaume Fayette.
Yeah, after a two-week absence, I'm not sure, how do we do this? I speak on a mic, and we record, and people listen?
It did feel like more like 2 years that you were gone. And someone I know who shares that sentiment is James Jones.
My alternate persona is Skullomania.
Yeah, well, speaking of skulls, we also have Mr. John Lindemann.
Don't worry, Guillaume. I can school you on the ways of coming back after an absence.
Oh, awesome.
John can
yeah.
school you on the ways of not talking for so long. I thought his audio had crapped out in the recording.
I do it every podcast.
He's just testing us. No, we are all four back together and very happy about that. We were planning on doing Retroactive this week, but we just haven't played GoldenEye enough. So we're gonna push it back. We're going to play as much as humanly possible in the next 7 days.
I want to say now, if your game doesn't respond to your button inputs, unplug your WaveBird controller, because this game's fucked. Home button still works, though. That was good.
I could also, little tip for people who might be easily confused by the dumb menu system in this game. You find your friend code under the party invite submenu,
yep.
And that's also
yep.
where you add friend codes from other people.
This game had a party system.
Yeah, it does have a party system in it, and it works. It has issues, but it does work its intended purpose. But we'll mm-hmm. talk about that later. Anyway, there is still time for you guys to play with us, and we're gonna have some official events. I'll talk about that a little bit later at the end of the show. But we're gonna play more GoldenEye, and we will finally talk about it next week. So please do join us. It is a great game, and this is pretty much your last chance to play that game online. And I think it's worth playing online. It's really good, and
yeah, it's well
you
done.
Can play with us. Let's meet up. Let's do it. Let's
play with
together.
Me, people. Play with me.
Yeah. Mm. Right now we're going to talk with you in new business, but we are going to start with Guillaume because he's been out, and I'm sure he's got a whole backlog of stuff to talk about. And a lot of it is Nintendo-related, which is helpful.
Yeah, indeed. I just want to touch back on Earthbound because I finished it right before leaving for PAX. And, we weren't really glowing in our impressions. I think that, and I still think that gameplay-wise, it's a really frustrating game. And necessarily, you know, in a good way, like, not necessarily, it could have been more user-friendly is an understatement. But I still really wanted to see it through because I was really taken by the story and the characters and just the general goofiness. Like, I just wanted to see what was around the next corner all the time, and the game did not disappoint. So, I just hope that, you know, people who haven't touched it yet, who were like, oh, well, I'm not sure I want to, you know, play Earthbound, or people who know who were...
have bad taste and want to play a game.
There's probably a lot of people who start it and then don't get very far.
Yeah, probably. I think it's worth sticking with it. But yeah, and I mm-hmm. hope that the people who do love it and were just, you know, like getting their knives ready and looking up where I live, you know, will back off because I did really love it. And there's, it's really hard to talk about without spoiling anything, but some of my favorite moments definitely are the kind of the tea, the tea breaks that you get. You know, at least twice in the game, a character offers you tea, and then all of a sudden, you get, like, this kind of psychedelic music or really relaxing kind of new agey tune, and then scrolling by or some, like, someone, you know, reflecting on your progress, on your journey, and like, oh, you've really come far, haven't you? Well, just know that the, the villain is, you know, shaking in his boots, and your journey will get tougher at this point, but don't fear, keep, you know, pushing on, and we believe in you, you know, like stuff
so
like that.
Do those kind of divide the game up into acts, like it's some sort of, like, you know, kind of like play or something like that? Is that how it's kind of spaced out, do you think?
No, I didn't really, you know, No, I don't think there's an Act 1 and 2 and 3. Like, it was more... It's still... The structure is still, like, get to the next town and solve the problem and get to the town after that. But it's just,
but it
you
gives
know,
you
like,
a pep talk.
Yeah.
I think it speaks to the fact that Earthbound never forgets that you that your main character is a little boy. And even though he doesn't really talk, they do characterize him more than is typical for games of this era when they have these kind of silent protagonists. I mean, they they don't pretend that he has become this amazing, like, world-saving hero with, you know, all this charisma and confidence, and, you know, he's running around, he just owns the place, he's gotten so incredibly powerful that nothing can possibly phase him. I mean, I think the game, it keeps reminding you, and in some ways very obvious, in some ways very subtle, that you're way out of your depth, and you're kind of going through this magical journey that will change your life, and that... I think it's nice because a lot of JRPGs will kind of set you forward on this path early in the game and then will leave you for a long time without really reminding you of what you're doing and why you're doing it and why it's important and how the things that you do along the way kind of lead you towards that larger thing. And I think Earthbound is better than most, especially for back in the 90s, of it frequently reminds you of what you're doing and why you're doing it. And I think that's really nice. And it does it in a creative way.
Yeah. And, you know, it really pays off at the end. And, you know, like it, well, yeah, I can't reveal too much, but you...
It's like a 25-year-old game.
Well, sure. But I was really glad to be, you know, to be surprised by a lot of things in it, even today.
Yeah,
you know?
I will play through it at some point, so please do not spoil it.
All right. Yeah, I'm still playing it, and I've never beaten it. I've gotten fairly far, and I've seen it beaten. I've seen other people beat it, but that was back when it was brand new, so I don't really remember what happens. I do recall that the final boss battle is really specific. There's like a very particular kind of sequence of things you have to do. And Guillaume, did you just look that up? I mean, did that bother you?
I did end up looking up something because it looked like I could make progress by doing the wrong thing, but it turns out there's a very specific thing, yes, that you need to do to actually beat him. Otherwise, you have no chance. And what's weird is that at a certain point, the thing that you're supposed to do looks like it stopped working. But yeah, you have to keep trying it.
Let's say if you've played Bravely Default, then you might be more inclined to keep doing the thing that you're supposed to do until it works.
That's spoiled two games, not just one.
Well, that's not really a spoiler in Bravely Default. It's you do it lots of times in that
game. But yeah, I really enjoyed the goofy dialogue. You'll see like this kind of serious looking businessman with a suit and a mustache, and you talk to him like he's just a regular NPC, and immediately, like very bluntly, tells you, "You don't look very bright. Let me explain. These stones are making a pattern. It's called Stonehenge." Yes, that's Stonehenge. You know, it's just all the characters are so kind of, you know, blunt and weird and tell you stuff out of the blue constantly. And it just makes it like it gives this the game a whole like surreal atmosphere. You know, like, what the hell is this? Like, what kind of world is am I exploring here? You know,
it's a world in which Stonehenge is located in America.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, well, I don't know. Like, you kind of cross a body of water, and the kid, I don't know, he could be, like, in some sort of British boarding school or something.
Yeah, I guess you could look at it that way.
Yeah.
It's abstracted enough.
Yeah. So I finished that. I really loved it.
So let's talk about a game that's not made by somebody huffing paint thinner.
Okay, well, I was about to talk about Mario Kart Arcade GP DX, but apparently James wants me to skip over it.
Ooh.
No, so I played that at a Dave & Buster's in Braintree in the glorious Massachusetts.
Good old Braintree.
Which, coincidentally, yes. that's just down the street from my old apartment, by the way.
Right. Yeah, it's the whole reason why we take a hotel there every year to, you know, when we go to PAX East. And
nostalgia. It's powerful.
Absolutely. So yeah, went to my first Dave and Buster's. Probably lost a lot of my hearing capability over there. That place is
and
loud.
A lot of your money, I'm sure.
Oh, it's so loud. Yeah, it's just crawling with children too.
They had various discounts, you know, and oh yeah, today is the day that all the games are half price, and
that's every day. It's not Friday, pretty much.
Yeah, and I spent way too much on points, and I had to waste some on crap that I, you know, that just gives you tickets and is completely chance based, and so that wasn't good. But a lot of time I've spent playing the Mario Arcade cabinet, and it was actually. Well, it was pretty interesting because this is a Mario Kart game only in name, and it's developed by Namco, and they've got a different idea of what Mario Kart should be. It looks like you've got the familiar
much
settings.
More like Ridge Racer.
That different idea is that it should be different sometimes.
Mm. Well, yeah. So, like the game starts and it's a little bit like Tank Tank Tank, another Namco game where you take a picture of yourself and you frame it around, like you can look like a Yoshi or like Mario or whatever. And so you see that the portrait of your enemies, of the other racers on your screen when you're racing them. So that's pretty cool. And you know, I would want that in a Wii version if one were ever to come out, which I don't think it will. And yeah, so you choose a kart, and there's only four racers, which, you know, makes the you don't get hit with crap as often. So in theory, that's pretty cool. Like it seems like okay, this could be more about racing and less about getting hit by blue shells and losing. Except that it looks like there's like rubber banding. You know, like to incredible degrees. I was choosing different characters. I was choosing Wario, which of course is supposed to have like a better top speed and less acceleration. Mario is supposed to be the all-around guy, and Toad is supposed to be more acceleration, less top speed. But regardless of which character I was picking, they all kind of handled the same. So that was a little bit disappointing. And
did you try Pac-Man?
I did. He's another all-around vanilla character. And yeah, there's no difference except for visually, as far as I can tell. There is a mechanic where you, if you press the brakes while you're accelerating, that's how you hop. And so when you hop, of course, you can start drifting. And when you drift, you're actually invulnerable to attacks. You've got this shield around you. And also, you're supposed to be able to, losing less of your speed when you're taking the curves. So again, that's good, but I really didn't feel that. Like, this is all in theory. This was all explained on the cabinet itself. But when I was racing, I felt like I always had everyone just tailing me very, very close. And, often just before, during regular laps, people would catch up with me. Inexplicably, and then fall back behind again. And only on the last lap did that seem to cease. Like every time on the last lap, whoops, okay, it looks like they turned the rubber banding off. So, yeah, I don't know how to feel about it. And I guess maybe arcade racing games stopped giving you a free game when you finish first in the early 90s.
It depends heavily on the game, but any game that features a major brand with it, so if it was a Ridge Racer arcade game, a Mario Kart arcade game, like Star Wars Pod Racers, those pretty much don't do it anymore. Anything that's like just random arcade thing, they're more likely to do it.
Right. So that was disappointing. I was expecting to get free games or to keep playing when I finished first, but no. But still, I had enough points to see almost every track. And the early tracks were pretty cool. Like there was a diversity in Mario themes, you know, but they were the classic settings, like the regular kind of meadow and Mushroom Kingdom and stuff like that, and around the castle and things like that. The tracks were really short, and you get only three laps. So again, it's an arcade game; they're after your money. And but towards the end, there were two Bowser stages and two other stages. I can't remember what the setting was, but they were basically identical. Like the two Bowser stages were basically routing you in different parts of the same level. but for the most part, you saw the same things. You took the same curves. It looked like, okay, well, we're only willing to make 8 tracks for this game, but for some reason, we want people to think there's 10, so we'll just cheat our way through that. So, yeah, I don't know. Like, if you've got... I wouldn't make a detour to a Dave and Buster's to go play this game. But if you've been suckered into buying lots of points, there are definitely worse games to spend your points on. So
certainly. But yeah, I mean,
at Dave and Buster's, there are way worse games to spend your points on.
Yeah.
I don't think most people ever... Yeah, I don't think there are any like hardcore fans of the Mario Kart arcade games because... You know, I've played them very little, maybe mm-hmm. once or twice ever, because they're kind of hard to find. And I mean, just arcades in general, they're pretty scarce nowadays. So even if you go in one, that you probably won't have one of these games. But I remember wondering back on GameCube and Wii when these games were coming out in the mid-2000s, mid to late, and I always wondered why they didn't do a home version. And it seemed like the consensus from people who played them a lot more than I did was just that they weren't that great and they probably wouldn't have translated very well to a home version. No. And even, you know, I mean, obviously they are completely separate original games made by a completely different company, but
right.
I think it says a lot that Nintendo doesn't really treat them like canon. You know, I mean, James has complained many times about Nintendo naming their recent games Mario Kart 7 and 8 because they're just excluding these.
That's not the real reason for the complaint. The complaint is that you just can't start numbering shit at 7. That's just fucking stupid and lazy. That's just, we don't want to have to come up with any more names. Let's just start numbering them.
Let's just call it Super Circuit.
Would that be better, James?
Yeah, that's a matter of taste. I mean, yeah. I think using those numbers, it does kind of, it corresponds to the relative sort of sanitary approach to the presentation on Mario Kart games in recent years. You know, like I've been playing Mario Kart 7 a little bit lately because with 8 coming out, we've been talking about it and watching videos of it. And I was like, you know, it's been a long time. I played 7 for like a month when it first came out and then never touched again. So I popped that back. I actually popped in a game card in my 3DS, if you can believe it. It's been like well over a year since I had done that. And I played some Mario Kart 7 and I unlocked mirror mode, which was nice. One reason I stopped playing is I felt like I wasn't really unlocking anything anymore, even though there was more stuff. It just had gotten so difficult and spread out. But as I'm playing it, like even the title screen is this menu where it's just like single player, multiplayer, you know, online. It's just really bland presentation. There's something, it's very, very clean, but there's no personality to it. And Mario, if you can't put personality into a Mario Kart game, why are you making it? Like, that game is all personality. It's all wacky, you know, crazy interactions on the course. It's all, you know, crazy characters, crazy carts, crazy tracks. And yet the approach to it has become very industrial. And I felt that way about Mario Kart Wii as well. And even DS, that was really where it started for me, because I thought the GameCube game had a lot of personality. And then with Mario Kart DS, I was like, you know, it's a really good Mario Kart.
I mean, it's,
but there's
it's
something about
it's
it that just feels very kind of soulless. I felt that way from the very beginning, and every single one that they've made since then, I felt exactly the same way.
I mean, online was the grand adventure for DS.
Yeah, that was a huge new feature. But
for Wii, it was already there. So like, it's got fucking bikes in it, and I'm like, hey, the feature nobody asked for.
Yeah,
yeah, it's kind of cookie cutter, you know. Little bit.
It's like,
you know what has bikes in it? Big Bumpin' has bikes in it. That's a Burger King game. So yeah,
well, I'm not even talking about gameplay features really. I'm just talking about the presentation of it. There's something about the menus, the sound effects, maybe even the music is just a little bit generic. And it's like, when did Mario Kart become so generic? This game was revolutionary.
I mean, I think it factors into the, you know, we've talked about it in the past. The fact that these series don't seem to really be experimenting anymore. I think the lack of personality and presentation is part and parcel with the lack of real meaningful experimentation in gameplay.
Yeah.
I mean, you say Double Dash is the last game you felt like had personality. Well, Double Dash went way off the rails in terms of design.
Yeah, and let me slip in the one game that's kind of related that I played at PAX East in the Retro Room.
Oh, yeah,
room.
Please. Get us off this trail, please.
So, yeah, like for the first time ever, I've played with three other people, Kirby Air Ride. And I had always been curious about the game, but, you know, back when it came out, it felt so redundant, you know. Mm. And back then also I was reading IGN, and I think they gave it a 5 or 5.2 on their very scientific scale of goodness of games.
They were trying to be edgy.
Yeah.
And I don't mean edgy as in, like, look at that edge. I mean edgy as in the magazine Edge.
So it didn't really draw me back then. But since then, you know, you always hear its fans who say, like, oh, this single-player mode was so awesome. Like, it was really like Smash Brothers or something like that.
It kind of become sort of a cult phenomenon over the years. Like, it always had a very small fan base, but there were people who were saying, guys, you don't understand. Especially, I know that IGN review's gotten a lot of criticism after the fact of people saying they literally did not know how to play the game. Like, they didn't even understand what was happening in this game.
I mean, the joke about that game is that you call it press A to not win, since A is break.
Right.
But, I mean, there's a lot more to it than that. And unfortunately, I think some reviews took the press A to not win meme seriously.
Right. Well, I think IGN did a test and they were like, well, see, we didn't touch the controller for the whole race and we finished second. And this
proves
it.
Press A to not win. Yeah. It's if you don't press A, you have a chance.
Right.
It's true. You're not breaking.
So unfortunately, I only had 30 minutes with the title, but immediately what struck me was that even in four-player split-screen mode, that thing must have been running at 60 frames per second. And it still looked good.
Yep.
It was very, very fast, very, very fluid. And none of us had played it, so we all struggled a little bit understanding how the drifting works and how, like, the boost pads, we had no idea that you have actually to press A on the boost pads to boost. We thought, well, it's probably automatic, like every other racer, you know?
Mm.
As we learned to play it, like, it really became fun, and the sense of speed, it's closer to F-Zero, probably, than to a Mario Kart game. So I really appreciated that.
Well, that's good. I mean, another observation I had playing Mario Kart 7 recently is that that game's not very fast.
No.
So mm-hmm. I'm all for... I think 8 looks maybe faster. It wasn't last year at E3, but I think it does now. But
it does look faster. But again, we've been seeing weird camera angles that aren't behind the cart.
Right. Yeah, that's a lot of not actual gameplay footage, just like replay footage, so it's hard to tell.
Yeah.
Anyway,
so
go ahead.
The whole, I don't know, what I'm getting at is that we did get some flack on NeoGAF and on our boards, and I think the site as a whole is getting some flack for not being excited enough for Mario Kart 8. But I do think, first, not being excited for it doesn't mean that we think it will suck. Maybe some of us mm-hmm. do, but I've started thinking about playing online with some people on my friends list, and I've started getting a little bit excited for Mario Kart 8. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to it. But more than that,
too.
I think that Kirby Air Ride shows that there are people at Nintendo, or at least who got their paychecks from Nintendo, who had different ideas for a kart racer. They did.
Or
you know?
How. I guess.
Yeah. Well, still, they were paid by Nintendo, and so they weren't allowed to touch the giant franchises Mario Kart, but they had to find another outlet, and they had to create a second kart racer just to put their ideas in it. So I think it would be there is space in a kart racing game for innovation, and I think it would be neat if Nintendo would allow the people that work for it to actually, you know, bring those ideas that they do have, like we know, or they had them 10 years ago, to bring them to Mario Kart. I don't think
you
it's
even have
to
go
ask.
Back two generations. I mean, look at Sonic Racing Transformed, which is a Wii U launch title. To me, is at least, you know, based on what we know now, to me, that game is more interesting in terms of the feature set, in terms of, you know, how it's trying to disrupt the flow of the racing in terms of what it offers to the single player mode than anything we've seen in Mario Kart 8. And there's still some stuff we don't know. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Mario Kart 8 will be a higher quality game in terms of the polish, in terms of the, you know, the level of work put into it. But for me, it needs to be more interesting than that Sega launch title. And right now, I don't know that it is or not. So I'm totally with you. There's a lot of stuff you can do in kart racing. And you know, I just don't know that Nintendo is all that interested in innovation in this series, because it's such, it's become such a cash cow. And that really started with the DS game. That was the one where it became a mega hit, and it sold so many DSs.
Forever.
For years and years and years. It was just a crazy thing.
And then
Wii
did the same thing, and it was a disaster for creativity in the franchise. I'll say it.
Yeah, they sold like 40 million copies of it on Wii. But then Mario Kart 7 on 3DS didn't do nearly as well. And I wonder after 8, because 8 is not – 8 mathematically cannot sell as many copies as the Wii version. So
no.
I wonder if this might start to push them back in a direction, because there will be yet another Mario Kart, obviously. And I wonder if at that point they would consider doing something a little more radical with it. Because
I don't know.
You know, there's not massive fan base to piss off anymore.
The thing is, though, they bank on it so much, and they have so few games to bank on, that I think that they're just perfectly happy not changing things up and not fixing what isn't fixed, if you know what I'm saying.
Nice. Nice. So I mean, Air Ride in its simplicity actually works really well for Kirby, because it is kind of this synergy of this character who exists literally as a placeholder graphic for a game that he ultimately ended up being the star of. I will point out, though, that the reason I point out is how this is Sakurai's last game he made working for Nintendo directly. And he left HAL after finishing it because he was tired of making the pressure to make sequels. I guess this was sort of his putting the idea to work of what, you know, what this is, what kind of kart racing should be if you don't want to be sequel pressured.
Right.
I do wonder, the idea of simplifying kart racing down to its most basic elements, which is kind of what this game does. It's not totally accurate, but that's one way of looking at it. Is kind of an interesting, you know, take that fits real well for that character. I do sort of wonder what you could do with Mario if you said, well, let's just start over. What do you want to do? Because it would obviously have to be a more complicated game, but I'm not sure that you'd end up with the same place that Mario Kart went. I mean, but I don't know. I understand that clearly shows, wow, there's options for creativity here, but there is a certain amount of franchise, like the franchise itself sort of limits what they can do to an extent.
Right.
I do wonder if maybe they should just make another kart racer and just not call it Mario Kart, call it something else. And Mario can be in it. His face can be plastered on the fucking box. But I mean, it could be just like, you should make a Smash Brothers game with carts. So you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, how about Smash karting?
They could also be, I don't know, a little bit less timid about the new things that they do put in, like the you know, run into obstacles when you're kind of hovering, run into people to actually accelerate. That's a pretty cool idea. Like, that could lead to making the game more like Burnout, rewarding risky gameplay.
But it's not really risky if you just are straight up rewarded for hitting somebody.
Right. So they would have to revise that a bit. But like, there is the seed of a good idea there. You know,
it's like it's just de-rewarding playing well, which Mario Kart does a really good job of.
No, it looks like it rewards being, I don't know, reckless and
the people who have played that feature seem to like it. So I'm holding out hope that is pretty meaningful. But Guy, to get back to Kirby Air Ride real quick before we move on, did your 30 minutes with the game leave you wanting more? Is this something you would consider going out and trying to find an old copy of it?
Well, I did consider it while I was in Boston, because there's so many video game stores and things like that. But over here, it's kind of a desert. And the prices on, Canadian prices are a little bit crazy.
If you had bought it on the show floor at PAX, you would have gotten taken.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, the only chance you have at a deal, and I did this last year after I went back to the show floor, was as they're packing up, because they don't want to have to carry that shit out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then you can probably haggle, you know. But there's so many people at PAX that I think it's probably difficult to haggle during the show.
Right.
I've never played Kirby Air Ride. I don't even know that I even played a demo at E3 the year that it was there, because it just it looked so unappealing at the time. And back on GameCube, we were a little bit spoiled for those kind of high-speed arcade racer games. And now, not so much nowadays.
Yeah, there was F-Zero, there was Mario Kart, and like, why would you buy Kirby Air Ride? You know?
There was Tube Sliders. You know,
there was
Extreme G series. Yeah, it was a more popular genre back then. So now that they're a little more sparse, especially hearing that this one, you know, some people think it holds up over time, and certainly it was one of the more unusual ones of the era. It's the kind of thing I could see myself going back and trying to find a copy of, just out of curiosity. So maybe one day we'll do that. Anyway,
Extreme G sort of in that same territory, because a lot of people hold it, really revere it, but it was always dealing with other games around it, so it never really got the attention it probably deserved.
Yeah, I played a couple of those Extreme G games, and they're not the most polished. I mean, they're Acclaim, you know, produced.
Right, they're Acclaim and they're Probe, yeah.
Yeah, so they're not the most polished, but they have some interesting mechanics, and they looked incredible at the time.
So on Amazon.ca, the Canadian site, I could get a copy of Kirby Air Ride for the low, low price of
$74.99. What the shit?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll put it on the GameCube Virtual Console wish list.
Check eBay as well. I mean, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
I don't really buy my two to three generation old games anymore off Amazon. I always go after eBay.
Jesus Christ. On Amazon.com, $109.
and don't try to buy games like that right after PAX East either.
Let the market
chill out a little bit.
Huh. That's interesting.
This is my advice to you as somebody who spent a lot of money on a video game system that nobody in North America has ever owned just to sell it a week and a half later.
Oh, wow.
All right. Well, let's move on, guys, to John's new business. John has played a game this week.
Yeah, I have. It's an obscure title, something I don't think anybody has really played very much of.
Super Mario Brothers.
3, to be exact.
Oh, damn it, I was just joking.
Wow, they made 3 of those?
They did.
Tell me more.
I'm playing the third one, buddy. I, of course, as longtime listeners of the podcast will know, I have not beaten Super Mario Brothers 3. I think it's one of the only, I mean, aside from the 3D ones, that I've taken a pass on a lot of those ones, but of the original 2D platformers, it's one of the only ones that I haven't beaten.
Is the lack of save the biggest barrier for you? I mean, because that is a kind of a killer.
Yeah, probably part of it. I think the fact that I can use save states in this will guarantee that I will make it through and not fall off the track. Because right now,
this is.
Go ahead, James.
I would say this is one of those Famicom disk system coming back to bite North America in the ass things. Because you could just save on the opposite side of the disk.
Yeah.
Curse you, Japan.
I mean, and the thing is, you know, I think I'm in World 3 right now, and that's where it just gets to be a real pain in the ass. You run into some parts of it that are just really, really hard if you lose any of your power-ups and you're just, like, small Mario, where, you know, I think, who said it? The other week when we were talking about it, and they said that it turns out, I think it might have been Scott last week. He said that a lot of areas just turn into, you know, platforms that you keep falling off of. And that's, it's very true. You know, especially platforms with water underneath. So as soon as you fall into that water, something's in the water that comes through and hits you.
I think we missed this when 3D Land came out, but I think that's part of the 3D Land homage. I mean, they spent a lot of time showing off the Tanuki suit, but I think that's part of it as well, but just floating platforms in space.
Yeah, it's pretty tough and frustrating, and you know, you'll run through a couple of areas like that, and then you have to just do something else that's just equally as annoying, and of course, you know, you get killed and you lose all your lives, and then you start back at the start of the world, and you know, like at 3-1 or wherever you are, and you have to do it all over again. It's frustrating.
I'd be really surprised to see a Mario fan who really loves the most the water levels.
Yeah.
They're so annoying. And they are. You know, plodding. Yep. Because none of the levels in Mario 3 are really that long, but the water ones
are
the longest.
Some of them are remarkably short.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's what's kind of surprising. The water ones are the longest just because you're so slow.
Yep. And yeah, it's actually, you know, it's surprised me how short they typically are. And actually that's what makes it really good, I think, as a portable game. Because typically the way they're structured is, you know, you have kind of a preamble and then you have the core of it where it's, you know, you have to overcome some obstacle that's fairly hard, and then all of a sudden you're at the flag. And so I think it really works better almost as a portable game. It almost works better than it would a console game to me, because I don't know. It's just, it seems, especially with the save states on 3DS, you can really kind of hop in, save where you are, and then come back. Not that you really have to a lot, but there's a couple of places where I'm just like, okay, I beat that. I came out of there with 3 or 4 lives. Just get me the hell out of here. And I'm just going to save after this, so, you know, so I don't have to keep going back to it, because some of them are a real pain in the ass. Some levels are just really, really annoying.
Yeah, John, I have a feeling that people are listening to this, and some people are probably really looking down on you right now for talking about the difficulty. Like, but
more than usual?
Well, I feel like, yes, because this game is so popular and so revered, and there are a lot of people who've been playing it consistently for 30 years. You know,
well, like, and to be fair, it's not as difficult as its two predecessors.
It, in some ways, it's more difficult than the first game.
I don't know.
I think it demands more diverse skill set from you.
I think it demands a more advanced skill set than the first one does. The first one is sort of the same stuff over and over again. So,
sure, but I think the degree of difficulty of the first one is probably higher.
Yeah, I think so, because like getting from world 8-1 to 8-4, you know, when you don't start with a mushroom, it's really, really challenging.
Yeah, those levels are brutal.
Oh, and you don't have continues.
Yeah.
Also, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the brutal part of that game.
Yeah, but...
have continues. You just hold select and push start. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not proper continues like this game. It's like, would you have to continue?
Well, no. I mean, Mario 3 does have some concessions. You know, you have the inventory on the map screen. You have the two-player mode where you can actually take turns and one person can get through the level that the other person's having trouble with, and then the other person doesn't have to play it. Whereas the two-player mode in the original Super Mario Brothers is very rudimentary. It's basically you're both playing the game independently. You're just
taking turns doing it.
Like, Mario and Luigi never, ever interact or meet face-to-face, or even, you know, like, what one does has no impact whatsoever on what the other person does in that game. And Mario 3...
Are you suggesting Super Mario Brothers is parallel universes?
No, yes, and in which people evolve from dinosaurs.
But I have just destroyed the canon!
In Mario 3, like, I remember... being a kid, I was mostly playing this game by myself by the time this game came out, and now I'm playing it by myself. And as I go through these maps, and I love the world map, like, that was so revolutionary at the time. It was so cool. It really creates this world that didn't exist in the other games, right? So you have not only the artwork that you see in each individual level, but it very clearly telegraphs that all of these levels are part of a place, and that there's other stuff that you can't even go play, but it's around, you know, and that was really important back then for kind of establishing the world of this franchise. But as you play through these maps, there's a lot of things, like there'll be a pipe right at the beginning of the map, and you go in it, and on the other side, it doesn't go anywhere. It's blocked by a rock. And you think, why is this here? Why would you, like, even by the time you get there and you break the rock, that pipe is not taking you anywhere you haven't already been to. But a lot of these there's like alternate routes that don't seem to serve any purpose. A lot of that stuff ties into the two-player mode, because you can take turns. One person can clear a level and the other person can't play it. And so then the other person skips ahead to the next level. And there's some strange stuff like that, especially as you have elements like the Hammer Brothers that move kind of freely around the level and can sort of ambush one person and not the other, and can take up your turn to play. So, you know, sometimes instead of you getting to play the level that you want to play, a Hammer Brother will come up and ambush you. You beat him or you don't, but then the other person gets to play the level you wanted to play. So it messes around with that. And in two-player, it's a very different experience, not to mention the fact that they put in the classic Mario Brothers game when you land on the same space. And that's kind of interesting as well.
Yeah, see, I've never played the two-player, obviously. So that's pretty cool. I'd like to actually see that. Yeah. That'd be interesting.
It makes the maps make a lot more sense when you play the game in two-player. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just kind of talking about, you know, see, that's comparing it to the first one. I think a couple of things that make it harder for me versus the first one is, number one, Mario's jumping is a little bit looser than the first one. His jumping is very, very tight in the first one. In this one, it's kind of like how he is in more of the sort of DS and 3DS later games where you jump and he has like a huge jumping arc. So that's sort of, I can see where that's coming from now. And it changed back closer to where it was in Super Mario 1 in Super Mario World, as I can recall. Hmm. But just the feel of his jump for me was a little bit off-putting to start off with. And also the thing that I find most annoying is that when you hit a question mark block, the mushroom, you know how in the first one, if you hit the block on the left-hand side, it goes to the right, or on the right-hand mm-hmm. side, the mushroom goes to the left? Completely does not do that in Super Mario 3. It goes really? Wherever the hell it feels like. Yeah, it goes wherever the hell it feels like going. So I will hit a block.
Just like me.
I'll hit a block on the right-hand side and go over to the left to expect it to go that way, and it'll go over to the right. And it does that all the time, and it drives me up the wall. It's so unpredictable, it just drives me crazy.
Do you think it's random or designed? I thought that you could control it.
Oh, God.
It.
Oh, I thought it was, believe it, I me, thought so in the do first I. Game, it,
for some reason, I thought in the first game, it always goes right no matter how you hit the block. And it wasn't until the third one that they introduced the nuance of you being able to sort of shift it if you hit it on a certain corner.
Well, I try to do that, and it doesn't do it. And I remember.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, it's a pain in the ass. Because I specifically try to do that, and it doesn't do it. So, but yeah, there's just little subtle things like that that make it, for me, more difficult, typically, just normal playing kind of thing. Just little subtle things that kind of aggravate me. But, I mean, I'm still enjoying it. And, you know, it's not that I couldn't beat things. Like, you know, it's just I just don't feel like beating my head against it, you know. Mm. So. You know.
Well, it is a great game. I've been playing it on Absolutely. As well. I've been playing the Wii U version, mm-hmm. which I'm sure is, you know, no different than the 3DS version that you're playing. But for me, it has been interesting to go back through it for the first time in a few years. It's been a while since I played Mario 3. And for me, the weird thing is almost every single level has some kind of element, whether it's an enemy or some kind of level design feature, you know, a kind of block or a kind of platform, a power up, a P switch, you know, the boos, the ghosts, the thwomps, the things like that. Stuff that you've seen in a dozen Mario games since then. But it all started here. Like all that stuff was introduced in Mario 3. When the day that it came out, I tweeted a kind of a semi-slam at Nintendo, and I said, it's nice to play a Mario game that isn't primarily designed around nostalgia. And I really do mean that, because the exciting thing about Mario 3 when it first came out was that almost everything in the game was completely brand new. You'd never seen anything remotely like it before.
Right.
And that just doesn't happen anymore. I mean, even by World, there were some things in World that were still kind of hearkening back to 3. You know, there's the P switches, there's the boos. Actually, in Mario 3, there aren't ghost houses. But in World 2, the desert world, there's a fortress. You know, every world has a fortress halfway through. That was also introduced in this game. And when you go in the fortress of World 2, it's basically the prototype ghost house, because you've got the thwomps, you've got the dry bones, you've got the boos chasing you, and you've got spikes going up and down and secret doors. You know, there's a door that is hidden until the spikes go up and then the door rises up from the floor. And that stuff was so cool. And that basically became the prototype for the ghost houses that are all over Super Mario World. And it's just like, if Nintendo had continued to craft Mario games where with some kind of like internal dictate that said at least 80% of the content in this game has to be completely brand new stuff that no one has ever seen before, I think Mario would be in a very different place today. But after they've done so very many of these, even the new Super Mario Brothers series has so many entries in it at this point that they're just recycling this stuff over and over. And I think that's why people love Galaxy so much, because Galaxy really does throw a lot of that stuff out, and it creates a lot of new enemies and environments and level features completely from scratch. Yep. And you go into a world and you really have absolutely no idea what's going to happen. And when you see things in that game, in those games, you don't know what they're going to do when you jump out on them or when you approach them. And that was the feeling that we used to get from the 2D games, and it's been lost. And I would love for Nintendo to go back and make Super Mario Brothers 5 or whatever they want to call it and just throw out everything. It's still a Mario game. You still run left to right and you jump and maybe you get coins. But other than that, everything else is completely brand new and it doesn't rely on nostalgia at all. I think it would be amazing, and it will never happen. But it did back in 1988,
89. Yeah. Like, do we really need to see the Fire Flower come back again?
No.
You know, like in Super Mario 3, it was the power up that you didn't want. You know,
right. it was the shitty old school one. Yeah, that was the nostalgia item in Mario 3, and it's not that useful. It's really, it's like, man, I accidentally lost my raccoon tail or my frog suit because I got that flower when I didn't want it.
Yeah, right. So it would be nice, and don't just change it to an ice flower or a gold flower. Just no flowers at all. Like, we've had enough, I think.
No flowers.
To be fair, I do actually really enjoy the gold flower in New Super Mario
Bros. I thought the gold flower was more fun to use than the favorite part of that game.
It doesn't sound that interesting in theory.
The gold flower is not that interesting, but in practice, it's pretty interesting, and it does change the way you play. It's just hilarious, really.
Sure. Is what it comes down to.
Yeah, I mean, I would just really like them to do a game that was maybe not set in the Mushroom Kingdom and just something just totally different, just completely radical, off the wall.
Well, they did that in World.
Just toss it. Yeah.
And World is
John, you know, wants to be set in a fictitious Middle Eastern country.
That's Mario. Hunting terrorists. That's Mario 2.
Yep.
Hunting terrorists.
But that's the thing. I mean, they really couldn't reinvent it. It's all just kind of, you know, it's just fantastical. So they can do whatever they want with it, but they keep coming back to the same tropes. So that's kind of I think that's a problem I wish Nintendo would solve and just kind of be a bit more daring. But I mean, I think that's generally a criticism that we have across a lot of their franchises, Mario Kart included. So,
and it really, it's very stark when you go back and you play these old games with fresh eyes, you know?
Yeah.
And you see just how innovative they were at that time.
Yep.
And why does that need to stop? You know, there's no good reason that needs to stop, except, you know, just a general kind of sense of conservatism or timidness or whatever you want to call it. But a lot of the people who made these games amazing and so exciting are still there. They probably still have it in them if they are allowed to do it.
Yeah.
And I just feel like the constant recycling, the nostalgia, you know, fetishism that surrounds Nintendo, especially with the Mario series, I think it does more harm than good. And especially as you do it over and over and over again, you get diminishing returns, and that's why, you know, four guys who do a Nintendo podcast aren't that excited about Mario Kart 8. It's not the number in the title that bothers me. It's the fact that I feel like I've seen most of what's in that game already multiple times.
Mm-hmm. To end on a more positive note, I want to say the cat suit was a step in the right direction.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It does something new. Sure, it's another animal suit, but it doesn't make you just float, just like every other Mario item. It doesn't make you shoot anything, so it's like a new use and new powers, and actually works well in the platforming setting.
And the double cherry, the same thing. I mean, those are people's two favorite things about that game, because they're the two newest things in that game. But that game, you know, 3D World, and I love it to death, but it is also full of crap that you've played a bunch of times, you know, already. And I would love a clean break. I would love a Mario reboot. Let's have the Mario Brothers, you know, the Super Mario Brothers, and just start over. Because why not? It's not like those other games go away when you do that, you know.
They actually do.
All right,
that's the tact Sega has taken. Every time we reboot Sonic, the previous one didn't exist.
Some series just are beyond saving.
Don't even bring up Sonic in the same segment as Super Mario Brothers 3, James. That's just
fine. I'll bring up Alex Kidd next time.
Good God. We can
all go play rock, paper, scissors to decide whether or not you win the game.
Actually, I'll bring up another NES platformer series. I've been playing Adventure Island 2 on 3DS on Guillaume's recommendation from a few weeks ago. I was curious because, you know, you mentioned that this is one of the only 3DS Virtual Console games that's never been released on Wii.
Yes.
Or even Wii U, for that matter. And I thought that was really intriguing. And then your description of it made it sound like it still had a lot of the weirdness of the first Adventure Island, but it wasn't broken.
Yeah, it's
a so that was more, appealing.
Yeah, it's more fair.
It is more fair. I'll say it is still a remarkably difficult game, and I am abusing the hell out of save states on this game. I can't imagine that I would have appreciated this very much if I'd played this back when it first came out. I think I would have been very annoyed by it. The game is so difficult. And in a way that to me at times does feel a little bit unfair, you know, because it's not an endless runner, but it is very fast paced. There's this hunger meter at the top that encourages you to keep moving forward quickly and to collect fruit and don't stop too long. You do have to stop sometimes just for the timing to work out, the platforming and the weapon usage. If you want to hit the enemies, sometimes you need to slow down or else you're just going to run right into them. But for the most part, you need to keep moving forward and you probably need to run as much as possible if you're going to succeed in this game. And the game knows that because they force you to do it. And knowing that, they will put things in places so that you'll land on them, you know, or they'll make enemies pop out. There have been times where I thought about Ninja Gaiden, you know, the way those birds will swoop in at you after you jump off the ledge.
Yeah.
There are moments that remind me of that. And I think that's unfortunate in Adventure Island 2.
The birds don't respond though. Let's not scare away people too much.
No, they don't respond. If you know that they're there, you can avoid them. But that's the problem. Like a lot of times I play through these levels and I feel like if you made it through the level the first try, it would be really mostly luck. You know, there's a tension between them pushing you to keep moving forward as fast as you can and yet having to be meticulous enough to take out these enemies before they attack you. And sometimes in order to do that, you really kind of have to be expecting it. You have to know that it's there because they don't give you enough time to react otherwise.
When I'm playing, I'm just constantly running, jumping, even when I don't need to, and throwing my weapons at stuff that's not even on the screen yet. I'm just taking no chances.
Right.
Everything has to die.
Speaking of the weapons, you have this kind of stone axe that you throw. It is a very common item, but if you die, you lose it. And if you don't have that stone axe, you are screwed. There's so many pieces of this game where if you don't have that stone axe, I'm not even sure it's possible to get through. And that's where the save states have been a real life changer, because I think this game does have continues. I think it resets you back at the beginning of the world that you're at, because it has a world map, which is nice. Yes. I really like the artwork a lot. But when you restart, you lose all your items. And even having to play through the first third or half of a level without the axe, I find to be incredibly difficult. And I just don't want to deal with it. So for me, when I die, if I reset to a save state, it's not because I'm worried about running out of lives necessarily. It's because I don't want to have to go through that level without a weapon. And I don't think you should have to. I don't understand why there's a condition that your character can be in, your little Master Higgins character, where he doesn't have a weapon. This game is impossible without a weapon. So why do they even make it possible to lose your weapon? You know, you should always have that. And then sometimes
because when you got to survive on the island, you need to live by your own rules.
Yeah, maybe
sometimes
it's just
you're
a
not
survivor.
Gonna have it. If it bleeds, Master Higgins can kill it.
That's right.
You do slaughter a lot of seemingly innocent wildlife in this game. That's for sure.
That's how you know he's the master.
Yeah, it's much more aggressive and violent than the Mario series.
If it bleeds, it dies.
Because you are tossing weapons all over the place, and sometimes you get these power ups that let you ride on dinosaurs. And I'm
he's
sure they
riding.
Put it in there because they thought kids would think it's cool. But the dinosaurs are not at all helpful, and they don't. They're treated like power-ups because you break a hidden egg and this little spade or a little diamond or heart symbol comes out. And when you get it, it gives you a dinosaur, but all the items are in eggs. So it's not necessarily that the dinosaur is hatching. It's like even in the first game, you got the skateboard out of an egg. It doesn't make any damn sense. This game is obsessed with eggs. You get an egg at the end of the level that just contains points, you know. But the dinosaur doesn't even feel like an upgrade. In some levels, it feels more like a liability because they move even faster than you normally run.
Well, I'll tell you what. You get on the back of an elephant and try to squeeze it to death with your calves and see if it feels like an upgrade on your day-to-day life.
I wouldn't try in the first place, James. But they shoot these projectiles that don't even have as good a range as your axe does.
But they come out
at a different angle. And it just I don't find it – I avoid them most of the time.
Oh, really?
If I see one of those dinosaur symbols, I just jump past it.
I don't know. They're fun to use, and like the land dinosaurs actually, the stuff that they shoot can take out rocks, which normally you can't take out. So
true.
That's like one less obstacle for you. And the pterodactyl, you can drop rocks from above, and it's almost impossible to use, but it's still really fun.
Master Higgins, the first purveyor of combined arms assault. Great.
Yeah, I'm not even sure I've found the pterodactyl. I did a couple times find a secret key that took me up into the sky where I talked to a pterodactyl god who allowed me to warp to the next world. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Are we back to the paint thinner conversations here? What's going on?
Hey, this game is weird for sure. But I mean, it sticks with the sort of, you know, dinosaur island kind of vibe pretty well. Like it's very thematically consistent, I think. And it is fun. Like I'm enjoying it. I think the music is really good. The graphics are not that great in the levels, but like I said, the world maps look really nice. And some of the character art, the weird elder god pterodactyl in the sky thing, that guy looked really cool. You know, so some of these larger characters that you encounter look really good. I think I fought a boss that looked really impressive. Most stages are, you just run from one end to the other. And the platforming is, I'd say, like, especially compared to something like Mario 3, the platforming is very simple. It's not anything remotely as complex or sophisticated. And there's not that much verticality to the levels. The screen can scroll up or down a little bit, but it mostly does that when you jump and then the graphics glitch out. So it doesn't even look that good. But the levels are very linear because they're designed to be played at breakneck speed. So it's paced more like Donkey Kong Country on Wii or Wii U, which explains why Guillaume likes it so much and maybe explains why I don't like it quite as much. But it is a good game, and it's certainly a hell of a lot better than the first one.
It
is playable and sometimes
the
fun.
First one is super old school. Holy crap.
But yeah, like Adventure Island 2 also looks much better than the first game. And it's got a couple of modern touches. Like you can store power-ups if you can manage to keep them until the end of a level.
That's true.
You can use them later. And the whole level or world warp thing, very convenient. And you couldn't do that, I don't think, in the first game. So you can see that they're trying to evolve the series, and I'd be very curious to play the third game, see where they actually got.
The third one, I mentioned it when you first brought this one up, but I think the third game is by far the most interesting of the Adventure Island games because it is more nonlinear, so it's more exploration-based, and I would guess much less concerned about you completing the level as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. And so I was always intrigued by it. I'll say the second one is fun enough that I would definitely go for the third one if they release that. Like it nice. Has me curious enough to see how the series continued to evolve even beyond this one. I wouldn't wholeheartedly recommend it, but I think it's interesting. And, especially, if you missed out on it like I did way back in the day, on 3DS is the only way to play it right now. And I think, it's a pretty cool little 2D platformer, so if you don't have enough of those in your life, it's worth checking out. And it is unusual in various aspects. I mean, it's not cookie cutter. It's not, sort of typical of the day. It has some cool ideas. They don't all work out, but they're interesting to see how they play out. And, it's charming. All right, cool. Well, let's move on to James. James has a whole bunch of weird stuff to talk about.
Yeah, I've got all kinds of weird garbage to talk about. So I'm gonna start it off with the Mario Golf demo on 3DS that came out today. It's the demo. I mean, it's Mario Golf. Camelot's making it. It is what it is. It's the only thing I observe. I mean, it looks nice. Looks very nice. I would say it looks, I mean, it looks on par with some of the better Wii sports games. So, it, I mean, it's a very visually solid game. It uses 3D well. The demo itself is, it's three courses of three holes. They're all kind of par four-ish. Then there's one where you have to get a coin floating in the air and make it to the hole before you hit the par, which is five. And then there's one where you have to get through three rings and do it. Same deal.
Sounds like a fairly sizable demo.
I cleared it in about 13 minutes.
So it's fast-paced. But that sounds like a lot of content for a free demo.
It's, yeah, I mean, I thought the coin level was, I was going to say awful. Because it doesn't really make sense what it's trying to tell you to do. You can't see the coin from the starting point of the course unless you go into camera mode and then scroll all the way to the end of the stage. So you're not entirely sure where you're supposed to be going. The ring one I thought was same deal. One of the rings is on a ledge beneath the ledges you're on, so you can't really see it from where you are, but you have to kind of start angling your shots to go for that one later. And then to get out of where you are way down there, there's really only a real specific angle you can take, and it doesn't line up with where it seems to want you to go to get the next ring either. So it's kind of a bad level layout for what they're trying to accomplish. They're trying to accomplish, can you accurately hit these rings in flight? Sure, but the rings aren't in the right place to make a consistent path towards the hole. So it's just, you know, it's not really well designed stage.
That mode has been in the series since, I think, the 64 game.
It has been, but I think this is just a particularly poor stage. So I mean, I think that the two non-basic golf demo stages are both bad. And then the three or the two courses. It's the two courses or three? I think it's two courses, excuse me. Of three holes. You know, they are what they are. They're Mario Golf. Not, I mean, visually impressive demo, content wise, it's pretty ho hum. There's nothing here that jumps out at me. I think that'll have to cover me for that particular game.
Next, you're not tempted to pick up the full thing.
I really wasn't before. I will say that during our staff meeting yesterday, I want to say the review embargo went up today. But the online portion for reviewers was not working
right
during the embargo window, which is awesome.
Makes perfect sense.
Apparently, it was on briefly in Japan, and they shut it the fuck off. So,
one thing that's been a hot topic this week is a couple of days ago, Nintendo announced the DLC plans for Mario Golf on 3DS, and the game's coming out at $30, which is on the low end of you know, kind of
for
big time
game, yeah.
Retail 3DS game. It's not unprecedented, but it, you know, it's a little bit unusual
for Nintendo. It's definitely low.
Yeah, it's lower than typical for them. And then day one, you can buy a $15 season pass, which will cover you for three different packs of DLC, which have both courses and characters in each one. And those are going to come out at some schedule. I don't know how frequently or how long.
Yeah.
Until they all come out. But
sort of monthly, bi-monthly sort of thing, I think, over the next 4 or 5 months, I think.
Yeah. And you can buy those individually, but, yeah. The fact that they announced this before the game even came out has annoyed a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and a lot of people are basically talking about this game like it's a $45 game. Now, I don't know whether that's true. I mean, I would assume that the base $30 game has a lot of content, but I don't know. I mean, I haven't played it. So I guess that remains to be seen. But
right. Yeah, in numbers, it looks like it's as big. Just the retail version that's as big as any other Mario Golf game that came out.
Okay, but so maybe it's like, maybe the DLC basically converts it into a kind of mega-sized, oh god, right. I don't even know what to do with all these courses. And, you know,
but
for me...
It does go...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, it does go back to the biggest fear of the proliferation of DLC, which is that content that in previous generations would have just been in the game, we could actually charge extra for this.
Right. And that's not necessarily what's going on here. The problem is when you announce it before the game even comes out and when you're selling season passes up front.
It absolutely looks like it is, though.
Yeah, it creates the possibility of bad intentions. It creates the image of, you know, they must have already done this stuff. They must have already created. I felt that when they announced this stuff back with New Super Mario Bros. 2 on 3DS, I thought they handled it very, very adroitly when it was Reggie saying, we don't know what's going to be in these level packs because we haven't made them yet. And we want to hear your feedback, and we will make levels based around the comments that we get from people who play the game. I thought that was really smart, and they're not doing that here.
Yeah.
And it may have all been lies, too, but sure. Who knows?
Could have been, but at least they sold it, you know? I mean,
the gameplay style of those DLC things were also different than the core gameplay.
Right.
And that this is core gameplay here. So if we get the game and there's, like, 10 characters, like, well, you can buy 10 more, I'm going to kind of feel like that was, you know, bad form by them.
Yeah, I mean, it begs the question, if you're selling these things as a DLC pack right now, why aren't you just putting them in the game and charging us $40 for it?
Right.
So, yeah.
And I mean, there's obviously an economic experiment that they're having here, but when you do something like this, when you announce, hey, here's $15 to get way more content, you have to understand you are operating in an environment where some of your competitors have done this kind of shady shit, and it does poison the well.
Mm. Yeah, I mean,
there are people who walk away having been burned by this before going, oh, so really they're just trying to get more money out of me.
I think season passes in general, you know, although of course if you buy the season pass, you get, I think, a $3 discount compared to if you bought the three packs separately, if you bought all three. But for me, the whole idea of a season pass is really, really edge case, because basically they're asking you to buy content when you don't actually know what's in it.
Right.
And in this case, they're actually marketing the season pass to you before you've even played the base game, which I think is in very poor taste.
Yeah. I mean, it's done with other games, though, but those games are known quantities.
And people complain about it in other games, too.
Yeah, but...
Oh, absolutely.
But the thing is, right, like something, you know, like, you know, an FPS game...
BioShock Infinite?
But the thing is, with those games, you kind of know those games. You can look at there's precedent for those games. You know what?
Sure, but you're getting into. Don't know. I'm not so sure about that. Like the people who bought the special deluxe edition of Aliens Colonial Marines. I mean, they
there's precedent.
Yeah, but that game's shit though. I mean, I'm talking like legitimate franchises that actually.
There's also
going to
be court precedent from that game, but that's a different edition issue.
Colonial Marines did come with a season pass that people paid for and probably couldn't get refunds for. But I just want to clear something up. Like, do you have to get the season pass for Mario Golf before the game comes out? Or, like, I mean, can you 2 years from now just buy all three packs for that reduced price? Because to me, that seems like the season pass is almost, you know, the wrong... It's a misnomer, you know? Like, it's just a bundle. And...
Right.
Maybe well, like in
they
5 years.
Calling it a season pass. I mean, that's Nintendo's terminology.
You're
asking a good question. We don't know whether they're going to stop selling the season pass at some point, because they've done bundling of DLC with Fire Emblem and with Mario.
Yeah.
But they are calling it a season pass, which is an industry term that means both good and bad things depending on who you ask. Mostly publishers seem to really like it because, of course, they love you paying for something before you even know what it is.
They can
before
start
they even
collecting
make it.
Interest on that thing early.
I mean, I think buying a season pass up front is immensely stupid for the same reason I think pre-ordering games is immensely stupid. I don't think you should pay for something before you even really know what it is. And, you know, and maybe you could say the same thing about Kickstarter. I think the calculus is a little bit different there because, you know, you're operating under the assumption that that thing may not exist unless you pay for it up front. And maybe not, there are good reasons for that to be the case. But
you're kind of hopping in like you know you want it, so you don't really care.
Right. I feel like they're preying upon people who really don't know better. And I'm never supportive of that. So I would encourage people to not buy the season pass, you know, and once the DLC comes out, all of it, if you decide at that point that you really are impressed with the amount of content, with the kinds of stuff they put in there, maybe they do mix it up. Maybe they put in weird characters who you wouldn't expect to be in a Mario Golf game most of the time. You know, maybe that stuff is worth the money, and then you can decide, and then you can buy the season pass. But yeah. I really wouldn't recommend doing it up front. I think that's gambling on Nintendo in a way that may be justified, but is certainly not necessary.
Yeah, and you know, like, look at it this way. The last Mario Golf was on the GameCube. It's been a long, long, long time since we got one. It might be a long time before we get another one. So, like, maybe in 5 years, you're going to be craving new Mario Golf content.
I doubt it.
Well, maybe. And at that point, you know, maybe you'll be glad that you didn't spend right away on the DLC, and you'll get it then, and it will be like a cheap, you know, half game.
Well, I'm really with James on this one. I mean, I don't see the appeal of adding characters to Mario Golf because all the characters do the same thing. You know, it's not like in Smash Brothers mm-hmm. where every character
yeah, but new
has
courses,
a unique moveset and you know, different characteristics.
There's so, value I mean, in new courses, I think.
New courses I could see. Again, it depends on how different the courses really feel from each other. I mean, to me, part of the problem with golf, with selling extra courses in golf, is that golf courses are made up of 18 holes. So it's not like one continuous level that, you know, is kind of built around a theme or something like that. I mean, in real life, golf courses are, you know, the holes are each designed mostly around what can we fit into the real estate that we bought and what can we make conform to the lay of the land without having to do a bunch of landscaping and crazy stuff like that. You know, it, obviously in a video game, you're not held to those same limitations, but can you really, like, if I show you hole 5 from one course and hole 11 from another course, can you really tell which course they came from? Like, that's what I wonder is, like, have you really played all the courses in Mario Golf so much that you've really exhausted the variety that they provide? Because if this game has 10 core, I believe it has 10 courses built into the base game. That's 180 holes. That's a shitload of golf holes. And they're all different. Do you really need to buy another 180 holes? Like, can you even tell the difference from one to the other?
Yeah, but what if it only has 6 courses built in?
Is that how many?
I mean,
I think it has 10, which is a lot.
Does it have 10? Okay.
I think, yeah, that seems like a ton of golf. It seems like by the time I get to number 10,
shit,
I won't even remember what number 1 looked like. So I might as well just go back and start over.
And all the 10 in the game are garbage, and then all the good ones are in the DLC.
I would have an issue with that, yeah.
Yeah.
Then we get on the plane to Kyoto and start burning things.
Well, it remains to be seen.
Toadstool Tour had only basically one Mario-themed course, and it was the last one. So that's fingers crossed that they didn't keep that actually good content in just the DLC here.
Hmm.
So the demo's got 3, but only one of them feels... I mean, they have the Mario aesthetic, but the only one that I played that felt really Mario was like Wiggler's Woods or something like that. But he does not do anything. He's just hanging out in the background, so it's kind of depressing.
He's just yeah. creeping on you.
He's just literally yeah, just hanging ball. Out above the course, looking down.
I mean, how does the game feel though? Like, does it feel like a Mario Golf game though? Like in the actual?
Yeah, I mean, it's 2-button golf. I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, the feel of 2-button golf. It's I press
yeah,
A.
Yeah, but I mean that's fun though.
I mean, then press A a second time.
I love all the
it's
Mario
the
Golf
Kirby
games.
It's the Kirby Air
so.
Ride of golf.
I mean, I'm looking forward to
Just
it.
Think
I mean.
Back. Think back to NES golf, John. It plays
well,
like that.
Well, I can tell you that actual real golf games are boring as shit. So
yeah,
yeah.
I mean, it's Mario like, Golf. It is what it, I mean.
I don't want a golf simulator.
There were no fucking surprises in the demo. Let's put it that yeah. way. Mm. Except Wiggler's gaping maw looking down at you during his stage, doing nothing.
A modern day Cthulhu.
He is a statue.
I'm still looking forward to competing against other people. Yeah. I'm looking forward to the completed reviews where they test that because.
Yeah, I think I'll likely pick it up and I'll take out Guillaume online.
It's mm-hmm. on.
All right. Well, James, we're running out of time. What if you have one more topic? What would you want to talk about?
So, Capcom. I want to say it was a Nintendo Direct. In Japan, where I want to say actually Iwata made the announcement that there is a new Ace Attorney game that appears to be somewhat far along coming to 3DS. Not particularly surprising that they gave it the full Nintendo Direct treatment, given the success that Dual Destinies had on the platform. and, you know, Nintendo's heavy, heavy, heavy involvement in Leighton versus Phoenix Wright, and their involvement in Dual Destinies in Europe, I believe. So, I mean, they're Nintendo's fully rolling the dice with Capcom on this franchise at this point. But the game they announced was not what you'd expect. So Capcom had said previously, possibly even before Ace Attorney Dual Destinies came out, or Phoenix Wright Dual Destinies, they freaking changed title on us again, that series creator Shu Takumi was working on a game. Now, he made the first three games and is responsible for the absolute masterwork that is taking the third game and retconning the first two games all into a single narrative. It is perhaps the most amazing act of retcon I have ever seen in my life. Or he planned that out so well in the future that he is some kind of genius. He's also responsible for the amazing and just amazing game / mind-bending story that is Ghost Trick.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
The dude,
I'm with you there.
The dude,
I'm not the biggest fan of Ace Attorney, but I think Ghost Trick is incredible.
I would say he is the definition of an auteur in game design at this point. I mean, he just does whatever the hell he wants, and he's really good at it. And he definitely does his own thing. So we have these games that he's made, but he's sort of walked away from the series. He had some interesting insight on, you know, having played Dual Destinies, mostly complimentary comments about what the work did, but he didn't work on that game. He wasn't involved. He was involved in the writing of Phoenix Wright versus Ace Attorney, which in Japan was like a 2013 game. He's been done with that forever. But they said he was working on a game. They then later came out and said that the team that was making, or the producer of Dual Destinies came out and said, we're working on our next Ace Attorney game. This was after the game had already been a big success. So the assumption was, oh, they're making six. Mm-hmm. Okay. And Capcom spoke about these as if they were separate projects, which, as far as we know, I guess they could be. If they aren't, the comments that Takumi made about playing Dual Destinies would be a little awkward. But he's made a game called Dai Gyakuten Saibon, and then there's a lot of other words that come after it that I can't remember right off the top of my head. But that would basically be Great Great Turnabout. I can't remember the full name now. But Dai basically is big or great in this case, in this context. It is a Ace Attorney, they don't call it a spinoff because it seems to play the same way, but it is a unrelated to the main franchise Ace Attorney game that takes place during the Meiji Restoration, starring Phoenix Wright's grandfather. So this would put it in around 1880.
What? What the
in
hell?
Serious. So I mean, I don't know how much we want to get into history conversation here, but essentially the Meiji Restoration was the emperor and his supporters kicked the shogunate out of power and began the rapid modernization.
Like, what the hell does it star, like Doc and Marty McFly?
No, it's just straight up like the premise of the game, at least according to the trailer, is you know, Japan in its rapid attempt to westernize, you know, has adopted things like Western judicial systems, and these ancestors of Phoenix Wright are essentially on the forefront of this. So I mean, it appears to be the same kind of game. It's just they've picked a super Japanese setting for it.
Well, I mean. The game's always been very Japanese, but I think this is kind of
except for the fact they all take place in Los Angeles.
Well, but they don't really. But yeah. I think this is kind of a trend in Japan that's been going on a long time. It's a popular thing to do when you have a big hit franchise to make a game in it that is set in ancient Japan or set in the past somehow. Yeah, Onimusha did it a long time ago back on PS2.
Are you saying that the next Phoenix Wright will have zombies in it, or?
Let's hope not.
Like, I'm excited about this game personally. It's a really particularly interesting moment in Japanese history where they went through about 500 years of modernization in about 40. So you're looking at this kind of rapidly changing society where they've decided to stick this franchise. It kind of makes sense, but at the same time, like the localization tasks in front of the Western branches of Capcom they must be looking at it going, oh, goddamn.
Yeah, I wonder how much of the story is leveraged on, you know, them sort of modernizing the Japanese legal system and sort of developing the new traditions of how all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this is exposition that for a Japanese audience you wouldn't have to make. They understand the Meiji Restoration. It's like one of the seminal events in the founding of modern Japan. But for a Westerner, that's like, whoa, what are you on about? What are you going? I mean, it doesn't, like, the art aesthetic. I mean, these are straight. I mean, this is way more Japan than anything, except for like the outlier stuff in the franchise. There's no calling this Los Angeles. Let's put it that way. I mean, that courtroom looks like it is from an imperial palace.
Would you say this is equivalent to sort of like the Wild West in America? You know, like this period of American history that none of us remembers, but everyone sort of knows what it is and can kind of identify the setting. And, you know, if it weren't for Hollywood movies, the rest of the world wouldn't probably know anything about the Wild West, right?
Yeah, I would say that that's probably fairly accurate, except the Wild West, you know, doesn't make a significant contribution to like where our society went, particularly.
It was ultimately kind of superseded by a more urban culture.
This is sort of like the Industrial Revolution plus the Old West, and I mean, it is literally the Industrial Revolution for that country.
Yeah.
But it's also this sort of cultural. It's a grand cultural reimagining of what society is.
Wow.
It's kind of a bizarre. I mean, it's an interesting place to put a game from a story perspective. And I know Shutsukumi likes to hear his own voice when he writes, so he probably looked at this because, oh, this would be a great place to write a story. I can write all kinds of stuff. But man, the localization editors are probably thinking to themselves, oh my god, what has he done?
Oh, it'll be four or five years before they have to worry about that.
But you know, Dual Destinies was a real fast turnaround.
It was.
I mean, a few months.
Yeah, but Layton versus Wright.
This is a much, much taller challenge. Well, Layton versus Wright is huge. That game is enormous. I mean, the amount of text, is my understanding, the amount of text in that game is astronomical.
So you're giving him a pass.
It's huge. No, I'm not, but it's huge. That game is enormous.
All right.
And then this also raises the intriguing prospect that the other game that the Dual Destinies people were making is a completely separate Ace Attorney game, which may mean that right now in North America, unlike in Europe where they've already got Phoenix Wright versus Ace Attorney, we may have three Ace Attorney games coming after what is essentially basically 10 years of them not making anything but Edgeworth spinoffs.
Yeah, but we heard that Dual Destinies did well in America, didn't we?
It did. It did very well. It did very well everywhere. Mm. It was a very successful game. And Capcom now has the ability to sell these games in the West without having to worry about the low profit margin of box releases.
Right.
They can, I mean, even if they get Nintendo to throw in some help promoting it, and let's say Nintendo in response takes, you know, a 40% cut versus the normal cut, they're still making way more money because they don't have to pay for the stupid boxes and the cartridge. So, I mean, everybody wins here. Except people like me who like to have box copies of all their Ace Attorney games on the shelf together. But that's fine.
Yeah, I would say, especially in the case of the West, they've already weathered the storm of the digital-only release. You know, they had got a lot of flack about that when it was first announced.
Oh, yeah.
But ultimately, people kind of just, you know, bit the bullet and
sighed and,
yeah,
and
they just,
I mean,
they paid for it and played it and enjoyed it anyway. And so now the next one should go over much more easily the next time they do that.
Yeah, I would prefer and to have paid more to buy a physical copy of this game, but I will manage.
Yeah.
Like I said, I'm excited about the prospect of this particular title. I think it's a nice way to take that franchise in a completely unexpected direction.
Well, I'm so happy for you, James.
And I'm thrilled that Shutsukumi is back making Ace Attorney games.
Sure, yeah. I mean, after Ghost Trick, I'm always going to be curious about what that guy does. This does not sound as appealing to me, but the historical aspect of it I actually find really interesting. It's just I stalled out so hard on Dual Destinies. I'm going to try to finish it one day, but I don't have the fervor for this series that you
do. And I don't – I mean, he didn't write that game. And it's not as well written as other work.
The writing is not really the problem. I mean, to me, writing is not any worse than the other ones that I've played.
I'll be curious if the game keeps the elements of it that made it a little bit more visual novel-y than its predecessors. Or if he moves back towards the more heavy-handed investigation stuff.
What I want to see is, you know, Ghost Trick had more. It was much snappier.
More of a game?
Yeah, more of a game and more the story.
Shut your heretical mouth.
No, but I mean, the dialogue didn't. There wasn't so much dialogue, and yet
well,
it
wasn't
said
really
everything that needed to say.
Well, Ghost Trick wasn't really trying to tell that heavy of a story either.
But still, I'd like to see a little bit less dialogue, or at least a little bit less filler.
I think that's really hard though in a series that is effectively a visual novel or a visual novel plus adventure game. I mean, dialogue is what makes that game go.
Yeah, but less is more. You know, like just having. I agree with Guillaume. Like my problem with Ace Attorney is that it takes forever to say something. And Ghost Trick did not have that problem. It may be the localization, but probably it's more the original script. I just thought Ghost Trick was very snappy. It was a weird story, but it got the point across, and it gave you it gave you more time to focus on the puzzles, which that game is definitely much more about that. I understand.
Yeah, I mean, the gameplay conceit of that game isn't finding holes in the story to expose untruths.
Sure.
The gameplay conceit is, how do I move this fucking little glowy dot to the other end of the screen?
Yeah. All right.
That's a big ask.
Yeah. Okay, well, speaking of using too many words, we have gone way long on new business, so we're going to take a break. We're going to have a short follow-up segment after this where it's a little bit of a grab bag. We're going to hear about PAX East. And maybe talk about episode 400 coming up in a few months, and maybe a few other things if there's time. But anyway, we'll take a quick break. Be right back.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have a review for NES Remix 2 on the Wii U by Justin Baker. A few months ago, Nintendo released a series of remixes of very early NES games in what is best described as virtual console marketing you pay to experience. The lingering thought was, I wish this included games that were actually good. Turns out Nintendo's genius marketing was even more insidious than previously believed, as they have delivered on the game that just 4 months ago you didn't know you wanted. But boy, does Justin make it clear, you do now.
Wow. We have an editorial comparing Wii U sales to Wii and GameCube sales by Neo. Don't read this. It's sad.
Now, better yet, if you read it, don't wait into the comments thread.
For the love of
God.
But, I mean, yeah, obviously.
You're only hurting yourself.
It's actually it's a very sober, factual article, which is why it's so sad.
Yeah, that's the problem.
And we have a review mini of Yoshi's Island on Yoshi's
Island.
Keep
reading.
Super Mario Advance 3. Okay. The Wii U GBA Virtual Console. Curious if the VC port of a GBA confusingly number. How do I read this?
All right.
It's a little typoed, yeah.
Yeah, it's fine.
Just ad lib.
Curious if the VC port of a confusingly numbered GBA port of a game from a platform that already had VC support on Wii U plays like? It's Yoshi's Island. What do you want from me?
That was barely intelligible.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Just read the line, monkey.
All right. Just look at the teleprompter. Okay, alright, we have a feature, Mario Golf World Tour Review, in progress, by Neil Ronahan. So the online modes aren't on, meaning...
There's no words there.
Again, barely intelligible. I'm just gonna keep rolling.
Meaning Neil couldn't review the game. There.
We're just gonna keep rolling. So the online modes aren't on, meaning that Nintendo couldn't...
Meaning Neil couldn't review the game!
So the online modes aren't on, meaning that Neil couldn't review the game by the time the review embargo went up. That's out of bounds. Ha ha ha. Kill me. Seriously, we can't review the game yet, so Neil posted his thoughts. But Nintendo, next time you're going back to the clubhouse. And we have an editorial. 3 reasons why I'm not excited for Mario Kart 8 by Alex Kulafi, because everybody wants to hear more talk about Mario Kart 8.
Shut up and read the lines!
It's positive.
Alex hates everything.
All the hate we got all the hate that we got for our lack of enthusiasm for the latest misnumbered Mario Kart title is misplaced. Alex is equally unenthused with the prospects at hand and breaks down why he feels the way he does. He also hates babies, so make sure he's your new villain. We love you guys.
That is canonical from the article. He speaks poorly of babies.
He does. He does also, not like children. That's it.
Also, this week we have a video. Check out Shovel Knight 3DS footage plus an interview. Yep, Shovel Knight is still coming. This time our friends at Third Rate Minion got some video of the 3DS version from the floor of PAX East and an interview with Yacht Club Games. And maybe one day we'll get to play it. And last this week we have a roundtable on Treasure Knot. Not all glitters, but maybe some gold. By Alex, Zach, Neil, and Guy. The crew at PAX East has some thoughts on Renegade Kids Treasure Knots. Let's say the general consensus is a lack of enthusiasm. Except for Guy, who's on board.
Neil says he wants to play more. I think that's a thumbs up.
It was less enthusiastic, let's put it that way.
I'm pretty pumped for it. Anyway, lots more PAX East coverage and lots of other stuff going on over at NintendoWorldReport.com. So go check it out. Okay, welcome back to the show, everyone. It's time for whatever. We're going to talk about a few things. It sort of depends on time permitting, but I wanted to start off with PAX East because Guillaume was there. It is a place near and dear to our hearts, and it was real
slightly
sad.
Slightly less near this year.
Yeah, I was glad that we had that listener mail last week. Even though I had to leave the show, I was feeling horrible. And the next day it was fine, but... I thought you guys handled that really well and had a nice discussion about the convention, about doing the panels. But Guillaume, what was it like for you being there without having the panel this year and with kind of a reduced cadre of NWR people?
Well, I got to say, without you guys there, I felt...
it was way better.
I felt betrayed. I felt stabbed in the back. You know, I expected a little bit more support. Just because we don't have the panel doesn't mean that RFN shouldn't have a presence at PAX East.
You're on your own, buddy. Sorry.
To be fair, John stabbed you in the back on that front, what, 2 years ago? 3 years ago at this
Absolutely.
Point?
That's what I do.
Yeah. it was probably less stressful, especially since, well, not that the panel was that stressful, except, well, the first time it was pretty damn stressful. But yeah, it felt more like I was just there to enjoy the show. And the fact that Nintendo wasn't there, so there was very little to cover, really.
Not that, I mean, really by PAX standards, there was very little to cover.
Yeah,
which
right.
Is saying a lot.
Already PAX East is not E3. You don't go there to cover a lot of stuff. But this year, there really wasn't anything to cover, you know? I did stop by the Renegade Kid booth, and saw Jules Watcham, who I don't think he's having a great time with their Kickstarter, and so
no, he's not.
He wasn't too. He didn't seem to be too happy. He was looking at his phone a lot and looking a little bit depressed. But the good news is that Treasure Knots is shaping up to be really, really good and really something up my alley. I don't know if you guys have seen Treasure Knots, but it's basically an offshoot of Mutant Muds, as far as I can tell, because it's the same kind of art style. It's 2D platforming. From my limited time with the demo, it's basically the same physics, same controls, except that you've got double jump instead of a jetpack. And yeah, it's just so it plays great. And
really filling that open niche there, Jules.
But the cool
it's
thing
is... It's more fast-paced than Mutant Muds, isn't
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah,
looks,
probably.
Looks like it to me.
Yeah. And
yeah, probably.
Well, I mean, it's hard to tell because there are some things that weren't really visible in the demo that are going to be in the full game. For instance, the demo was broken up in 3 levels in a boss fight. But the final game is supposed to have like kind of a Metroid progression where everything is interconnected and you actually gain abilities. You don't start off with a double jump, you know, and things like that. So The demo only gave you really a glimpse of what the game looks like and what it plays like, but it didn't really showcase the whole, you know, Metroid aspect of it. And also, the full game is going to be co-op. I think I forgot to ask or to look it up, but at least two players. I wonder if you can have more than two. But the big deal is that also it's download play. So you really only need one copy. And so some other person can mooch off of you and help you out in the levels. So that sounds pretty
cool. It's really
cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
There were some obstacles, you know, like there were three weapons available that you could use. You could choose it before you started the level. And there were some blocks that obviously, okay, this one you can only destroy using the sword. This one you can only destroy using the bomb. So I can assume that if you're playing co-op, then it's advantageous to both use different weapons and you'll maybe have to do less backtracking and things like that. So yeah, and also the bombs can hurt you and can hurt your partner. So there's some trolling opportunities there. And I'm really looking forward to it.
We don't really know when that's coming out, do we?
I don't know. It should be imminent, right?
So Nintendo's website says May. Mm-hmm. I asked Neil during the staff meeting yesterday, and his answer was no.
Huh.
And like that was the end of the. I mean, it was basically something along the lines of, I asked that game should be pretty close to being done, right? No.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna say you probably shouldn't run a like big time Kickstarter campaign in the middle of like crunch to finish another game.
Mm-hmm.
So that.
There's probably not unless you're like a big company that shouldn't be using Kickstarter anyway.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that were sort of ill-advised about the Colt County Kickstarter, and I think Jules has been he's been out
existentially.
There he's been out there talking about it, doing interviews. He wrote a fascinating blog on Gama Sutra, and there were some very very constructive comments in that article that he's been responding to very graciously, and I think those guys have learned some very hard lessons. Although ultimately, I don't know what they really lost. You know, I mean, it cost them some time and some, you know, psychic energy. It cost them a lot of emotional energy, I should say, to do the Kickstarter. But ultimately, you know, they aren't going to get that money, but they wouldn't have gotten it anyway if they hadn't asked for it. So, you know, I think.
Yeah, but if they'd asked for a smaller number, they may have gotten that.
They may have. But, you know, I do really appreciate and respect developers who say this Kickstarter goal seems high, but this is what we think it will make to make this game. The game that we are pitching, this is the honest cost to us to make this. And we're not going to ask for less than that just to get it funded and hope that we get a bunch of stretch goals, because then there's a chance that the game is funded, but then we never finish it. And then all you guys are screwed because we didn't ask for enough in the beginning, which is exactly what happened with Double Fine. And that looks like it's going to work out okay in the end, but they were in serious danger of screwing that up and pissing off a lot of people. So I understand wanting to give the honest budget for the game, but let's just say that companies the size of Renegade Kid and with the limited reputation that they have, which is not to say they have a bad reputation, just most people don't know who they are. Most people have not played their games. And especially when they're pitching a first-person shooter, when I'm going to say 80 or 90% of the people who even know who Renegade Kid are probably know them because of Mutant Muds. And nothing about Mutant Muds would tell you that these guys are capable of making a first-person cult horror game. You know, it's like I told them, like, it's been five or more years since the last time they released a first person shooter. They should have waited until after Moon Chronicles came out before pitching this, because then people will be able to jump in for $5 or whatever they're going to charge for that first episode and get a sense of what they're capable of. And then they might have been more inclined to support something like this. But they're just, you know, for that kind of budget, those guys are not well known enough for people to take a big chance on them like that. And I'm sure they've learned that, and I'm sure they'll go back and reformulate how to do this. But anyway, anything else at PAX that you want to talk about? Did you play some Joust?
Oh yeah, of course I did. But I think we covered that extensively, you know, last year, and in connectivity as well.
Yeah, there's a big like 3-hour long connectivity from last week that's all about PAX East. So if you want to hear more about what Guillaume and Neil and everybody else was up to over there, you should go listen to that.
Right. And there's, I guess there was the stand right next to Renegade Kid. So I did stop by there and they had a game called Cube Men 2, which was not, you know, super awesome. It was just a kind of a tower defense game with a couple of new twists. But what was really interesting about it is that it's coming to the Wii U, but also the PC and iOS devices. And you can play online between those platforms. So that's pretty cool to see. I mean, it's not, you know, even the first game to do that. I think that this new chess game that came out on the Wii U eShop is also cross-platform compatible. But still.
In the ultimate, wait, what is this game that has come out yet? Thank you, Nintendo.
Yeah. But still, like, it's nice to see. It's nice to see that Nintendo doesn't prevent that and that companies are actually taking advantage of it. So it kind of, you know, like it makes it way more likely that you're going to find an opponent if you hop online in any of those games. So thumbs up.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, nothing really to mention. I played mostly in the retro room. I discovered that Tetris DS multiplayer is a ton of fun, and I'm an idiot for ever getting rid of my copy.
and it's hard to find one now, too.
Yeah, it's good. It's a great game.
Yeah, the single player didn't really enthrall me. The whole, you know, you can keep spinning forever if you just smash the button, you know, I had an issue with. And the single player modes weren't all that great. But there's this mission mode where everyone is competing to be the first one to, I don't know, make two non-consecutive lines disappear in one shot or things like that, like interesting missions. And so you rack up points when you accomplish them and... it's a pretty cool way to play Tetris. And in the same vein, I played some Pac-Man Versus using... I think Neil got a copy of Namco Museum, one of the 3DS games. Or maybe it was a DS game.
Yeah, I don't think there has been one for 3DS.
Okay. So yeah, there like...
A couple for DS, at least a couple.
Right. So one of the more recent ones, I guess. There was a multi-cart download play... Pac-Man Versus. So that was pretty cool, but the game was actually chugging in some instances, so that was annoying. But more ways to play that game is always a welcome thing. And I don't understand Namco. They should be trying to put that on as many platforms as they can. I guess with Nintendo's involvement in the creation of it, maybe they can only put them on Nintendo platforms, but again, I don't see the problem. Put that stuff on the eShop, you know?
Yeah, why isn't that a Wii U game? You know, you have a person playing Pac-Man on the gamepad and everybody else using controllers, you know, to do the ghosts on the TV screen. I mean, it's perfect, just like the GameCube one, except you don't need a GBA and a cable.
Yep. You can actually execute on it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you always could. It's just easier on Wii U. It's a perfect fit for that platform. And it's really... It's the kind of game that probably gave Nintendo the idea to do the gamepad in the first place.
Right.
And it cannot be that difficult to make a version of that game for Wii U. I just don't understand why they haven't done stuff like that.
Yeah, and Nintendo Land has like two ripoffs of Pac-Man Versus. So.
Which aren't as good.
Yeah, so put the original on there. So yeah, and in general, you know, PAX East impressions, there were a lot of Kickstarters. There were a lot of indie titles. There were a lot of 2D, you know, side-scrolling action platformers. So it was really...
Ah!
Yeah, I know. Not necessarily for Nintendo platforms. Most of them for PC or whatever. So I was, I was enjoying them. I was enjoying playing a lot of demos of all these small games. But...
make something else, people!
Yeah, there was not a lot of AAA presence at all.
No, it did sound like that whole thing, that whole roll of the floor got cut pretty heavily.
Yeah.
Which makes Nintendo's non-presence there seem much less of an event.
Oh, yeah.
Right. All right, man. Well, we've got a little bit of time left, I think. So let's talk about episode 400. And my idea here was I've taken a few notes. I've been brainstorming on things we might do. Obviously, we're getting, you know, within striking distance. We're about 5 months away now from episode 400. And I'm planning for it this far in advance because I'm hoping to do something really special with it. But I think it's going to depend on our listeners. So that's why I'm kind of bringing it up now. And some of the ideas we've discussed amongst ourselves, some of them we haven't. So I'm gonna spring some stuff.
I don't remember. So go
on
ahead.
The crew here. Yeah, and we could talk about them. You guys give me honest reactions, and you know I'm not committed to any of this stuff yet. It all depends on all of us agreeing on what we want to do and talking about what's possible.
So we have not been prepped for this. These are gonna be real live reactions.
Yeah,
that's
an awful idea.
I mean, we've talked about it a little bit, but it's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while, definitely.
Yeah, you guys might not remember it very clearly, but in general, my overall feeling is, first off, I want to let people know we're going to do the best episode 400 that we can. I mean, I think we have a pretty strong history of doing special episodes for these anniversaries and finding different ways of doing it every time. And for this one, our eighth anniversary is in June, early June. The 400th episode will actually come a couple of months later than that because, you know, over the years, we have sometimes those special episodes rather than a numbered episode. And so the numbers get a little bit backed up. So it's going to take a little bit more than 8 years to hit the 400th episode. But I felt for this one, I wanted to do something that we've really never done before. And so, like I said, no matter what happens, we're going to make it as special as we possibly can with whatever resources we have. But my dream, and this is kind of what I want to float out here, not only for you guys here recording with me, but for everyone listening, and kind of get feedback and get input. And I think there's a lot of room here for additional ideas or ways to pull this off. And, you know, if aspects of this people don't like, let us know. Cause I'm curious, you know, but cause we do this for the listeners, obviously. But in general, my big idea, the best thing I've got going right now is that I would like to record episode 400 together in person in a professional studio. Is that appealing to you guys? Does that sound like something that would
maybe?
Be...
I mean, the part of together, that's not necessarily the it's like I'm not sure what we gain with the studio, but I'm open to it.
Yeah,
I'm open to talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm
still. Yeah.
I'm kind of you know, here and there.
Look
on
at
it.
John. I mean, that's kind of where I'm at, really.
Yeah, I mean, if we can. I mean, James and I can do it in different rooms. I mean, whatever. I'm sure we can. You know, maybe we can put up a curtain. I don't know, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, maybe we'll throw James in the drummer's booth. You know,
there
so
we go.
He's physically separated from everybody else.
Yeah, I just don't. The thing is with that, I don't know.
I don't like people, so I mean that it helps.
The thing is, my question with that sounds great, but I don't know if it's going to add anything to the show. I think that's...
Well, there would be...
It's cool.
Yeah, sure. So there would be other aspects. You know, I mean, the content would be special as well, of course.
Yeah.
So it's not just... It wouldn't be a normal show, but now we're doing it in a studio. Obviously, we would come up with some ways to use that. I think some ways to take advantage of it. But it would, to me, it would really set it apart from all the other episodes that we've done, and I think it would sound significantly different. And I mean, even if you just use a different microphone 1 week, you can tell on the show. So if we're, yeah, you know, if we're all like using professional equipment and having someone mix it properly, and really do it, you know, I think anytime we do the show in person, it has a little bit different vibe, but. But a lot of times associated with that is kind of a downgrade in quality, audio quality, because we're using a single microphone and everybody's sitting at different distances and you don't have the capability to go back and sort of post-process it and mix it as much in that case. So this would be something very different. And you know, obviously this comes out of my experience getting to do Weekend Confirm last year at E3. And it made a big impression on me, and I talked with Garnet a little bit about it when he was on our show recently. But I felt it surprised me how much it changed the experience. The setting of being in there, of using the really cool equipment, of having an engineer who's actually responsible for making the show sound good it, at the time of recording and not just after the fact, was striking. It made much more of a difference to me than I expected. It not only, I mean, you know, of course, I listened back to that show afterward and I sounded different than I normally do on this show. And that struck me as
you were also incredibly sick.
I was very sick. I was very nervous and I was trying to get in a lot of opinions in an abbreviated amount of time. So yes, all that is a factor, but it did sound different. And I thought it sounded, you know, different in an interesting way. And it made me immediately wonder what our show would sound like if we had that same opportunity.
Yeah, I guess my only issue with it is that I kind of feel like that's more for us and not really so much for our listeners. You know what I'm saying? Fair. Like, that's kind of where I'm coming from with it. Well, I get it. You don't really have to sell me on it. It would be awesome and really, really cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So yes and no. I mean, I think the experience of us actually getting to do it would be really cool, right? Yeah. That would be something very special for us four. Certainly.
Yes.
But I also feel like there's an archival element to it where we could produce an episode that sounds so different from all the other ones. And if that's the only time we ever get to do that, you know, after 8 years of making the show, we finally got to do it in a really professional way. And that one episode would be something that you could, you know, burn to a disc and give to your grandkids and say, there was this one time when my friends and I got together to do something really stupid and it sounded so amazing.
Unlike every other week when we get together and do something really stupid. Yeah. It sounds terrible.
Look, kids, this time terrible, I was sober.
There's only hey, so much you I can do no in promises. Audacity, you know? So that aspect of it I find really interesting. And I think you bring up a really good point, John, and that's one reason I wanted to do this on the show and to solicit feedback, because I want to know from people, is that something that's appealing to them? Is that – would it really be – you know, was that an added value for people to hear us like do a professional version one time only of Radio Free Nintendo? I mean, it's really interesting to me. It's really exciting to me. But maybe it's not to other people. So I want to.
John's
going to
sing
that
Andy
out
Get
there.
Your Gun during the performance. It'll be great.
So and content wise, there's a lot of stuff that we could do. And some of it would be outside of the studio part of it. So I think we would do a chunk of it in the studio, and then we would do other stuff outside of that then we would add on to it, you know, because we're not, there's some stuff I'd like to do. Like I'd like to get maybe some of the former hosts on. We've done that before and it's always really, it's interesting to catch up with them and see what's going on with them and to hear their perspectives on some of the more recent things that have happened with Nintendo that we haven't, you know, they haven't had a chance to chip in on. But you know, I mean, people like Greg and Carl and Evan and Mike. I mean, I always love to hear from those guys and catch up with them. So, I'd love to do stuff like that. And I think for the anniversaries, those guys are, you know, they're usually pretty cooperative. They're willing to help out. But I'd like to, you know, maybe get some messages from some of our favorite guests and kind of catch up with them, even if they're not able to jump on for a whole segment. I think us getting together, one thing I'd like to do is to be able to do it outside of E3 and outside of something like PAX East is to have kind of a more casual environment for us four to hang out and do things that we normally don't have time at these big shows. So I'd like to get together and like hang out on the couch and play games and record that, you know, or maybe even live stream it. And kind of capture, I mean, us four, we don't get to play games together, really, you know, like even online is kind of a rare opportunity, but especially in person, you know, at these big events, that's just not the focus. And when we do, those are some of my favorite memories of hanging out with you guys. And I'd like,
so I think to that end, I did find the old Make My Video PAX, YouTube featurette of John and I. Just sinning against humanity.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
That is a thing if you've not seen it. I am holding a straight up point and shoot camera recording John playing Crisscross. Oh, was it? No, it was Marky Mark, wasn't it?
No, it was Crisscross. It was Crisscross.
It was Crisscross. Make my video. Yeah.
Was that 3DO? I think, or was it Sega CD?
Yeah, yeah. It was Sega CD. Yeah, that's bad. It's basically me trying to get John to turn on every effect.
Yeah, it's
just so we can see how pixelated this already pixelated video is.
It's interactive.
Mm-hmm. And then me realizing that Carly was going to kill me for filling her camera with video of Crisscross make my video.
Yeah. So that wonderful magic could be, you know, relived.
There's no magic without Crisscross making my video.
Though. Yeah. So
somebody's going to have to bite the bullet on eBay.
There's a lot of stuff we could do in that direction. The things that are, you know, more and less stupid than that, but along the same lines. You know, by the time this happens, we will have Smash Brothers will be out. So we could do some fun stuff with that multiplayer. And a lot of, you know, Mario Kart will be out. There'll be a lot of multiplayer games that we could enjoy together in a way that we can't do the same way online. So I think that would be fun. And what I hope is that I think we're smart enough that we could create some interesting content out of that for the listeners. So it wouldn't just be for us. It's not entirely selfish, right? Oh. So that's kind of what I'm thinking. And, you know, the big impediment to doing this is that it would cost a lot of money. So, you know, to not only for the travel to get everybody together, but the studio time is
for Kirby Air Ride.
Yeah, right. The studio time.
I'm sure we can get you a copy out in LA in one of those fine establishments in the Gold District.
Yeah,
it's spelled with like a C, but it's fine. Don't worry about it; it'll work.
But studio time is not cheap, and I don't know yet what it would cost. It's on my to-do list is to kind of go out and do a little bit of research and find out about this stuff. I mean, our needs are relatively easy, I think, to accommodate versus, you know, a band who has to bring in a bunch of instruments and get a bunch of stuff mic'd up, you know, in kind of complex ways. So I think it's not a huge burden, but it's going to cost, I'm guessing, a few hundred dollars at least just for the studio time, and to pay for someone to do the engineering for us. So there's some costs associated with this. And so that's when I started to get the idea of maybe we could do crowdfunding. And I know this idea is, you know, some people are pretty sick of it and it is played out in a sense, but I think there's probably a way we could do it that would really involve the people who listen to the show and would reward them in some ways that I think are different than what you might expect. And this has been done actually a few times. Retronauts did it on Kickstarter and Idle Thumbs. And my current thinking is that we probably would not use Kickstarter, partly because I'm sick of Kickstarter. I think everybody's a little bit sick of Kickstarter, yeah. But I think something like Indiegogo or a similar service.
That's such a dumb name. Let's not use that.
Yeah, well, I have more research to do, but I think there are other services, and maybe we just do it through PayPal and collect it ourselves. But you know, there's a certain there's a confidence factor when you go with a service, because then they're managing the money and then people have more, you know, more confidence that they're not going to get taken advantage of. So I'm going to look into that stuff, but what I would like is a service that we don't have like a make or break target where if we don't meet it, nothing happens. You know, that's the way Kickstarter works. And again, it comes back to my core idea that we're going to make this the best that we can given the resources that we have. So to me, something like Indiegogo where people can donate money and you have a kind of a target in mind, but if you don't quite reach it, you know, you still collect the money, you just do the best you can with what you got. And if you go over that, then you can do extra stuff. So it's more continuous grade. And I'd like that because I feel like, you know, if we'll figure out the budget for all this stuff and it'll be very transparent, but if we don't raise enough to do all that stuff, then we'll trim it back and we'll do a slightly lesser version and we'll still make it as cool as we can. So that's kind of the way I'm leaning right now. And I think some of the other services have less restrictions on the region that you can donate from. Cause we do have a worldwide audience to some extent and, mm-hmm. And I don't want to keep anybody out. Just because they live in a, you know, in a certain country. So, so of course, when you do that, you know, people are expecting rewards. And I think this is fun because I was thinking about this morning, and there's some things we could do. Like on the really low level, we could have, some backer polls that where people who donate would be able to vote on some of the activities that we're going to do for the get together, and would have some influence over that. And that would, that
will
could
there be. Would there be like limitations, or could they just be like, well, you got to fill a bathtub full of KY jelly and, you know. Well,
whoa, why does your mind go there?
Yikes.
Guillaume, what were you doing at PAX?
Yeah.
What goes on at PAX stays at PAX.
I think we would probably create the voting options, Guy, so we could maybe keep it to things that are legal and not disgusting, or not overly disgusting.
Well, I think he's talking about mud wrestling.
Everybody has their own thing, Johnny. Let's not judge.
Yeah. Here's something. You know, I was talking to Nick Bray the other day. He said he's going to try to bring back the Powered Off PDF magazine, which James and I have been supporters of and have contributed stuff to. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if we could create like an exclusive issue of that for backers that's really focused on RFN? So we could have articles that relate to the podcast, and the four of us could write things for it, could contribute to it in some way. It's a very loose idea. I haven't even talked about this with Nick yet, so I hope I'm not going to scare him by bringing this
Nick's
up.
Nick's just now furious.
But I think we could maybe do something that is sort of collectible and would like – it's like really fan service kind of stuff. It's like stuff that people who have listened to all 400 episodes and haven't – already lost their minds yet, like this would be stuff that would be very appealing to those people. I think that's something that would be very doable. I think, you know, if we did a highlight clip, if we did a reel of highlight clips for the 400th episode, we could let people choose their favorite clip to be put in there. I think everybody has like their favorite moments, right? A lot of people are going to go back to 103 because it was such an unmitigated disaster.
It was a masterpiece.
Yeah, but there are lots of other episodes with memorable moments, and it's stuff that we could really use help with actually choosing that stuff, because there are people who listen to the show who know those back episodes way better than we do.
Yeah, that's
so
sure.
I think it'd be interesting to hear what really stuck in people's minds and to drag that stuff out of the depths and to put that in a highlight reel and expose it for everybody else.
Origin of Box Hunter. Thank you very much.
I'd really like to do some new t-shirt designs, and I've been looking at new stores where we could get much lower prices on the t-shirts and have a little more flexibility over the designs and stuff like that. So I think we could easily get an exclusive t-shirt design for people who back.
Yeah. Their... Actually get somebody that's a really good graphics design person to actually create
Absolutely.
A t-shirt. That would be really, really cool.
Yeah. And we could pay that person. So we could someone who's
exactly
actually
it.
Professional
yeah.
and will do a superb job, because it's associated with this fundraising. So yeah, I would love to do that.
Yeah. That'd be awesome.
And here's a fun one, James. I wonder what you'll think about this. I think, you know, one kind of on maybe on the high end of you know, donation tiers, but we could have you pick out hand pick a kusoge for people and like maybe write like a little post-it note, you know, it's like, here's why I picked this, and send that to people.
Like, oh God! The
world's
not ready.
Don't you think people would find that appealing? Like James picked this game for me to destroy my soul.
I'd have to talk to them to find their vulnerabilities.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You could, you know, get a little bit of background on what they like or what they don't like.
So, what do you hate?
Yeah.
Oh, do you by chance own an FM Towns Marty by any chance?
It'd be really fun to hear from them after the fact and like hear about their experiences playing their. You know, they're James Jones handpicked crap game. I think that'd be really funny. And then, maybe at the very, very high tier, I think while we're all together in the same spot, we could, spend some time playing games that have been chosen, by the backers. Even if it's stuff we don't already have, you know, as long as it's under a reasonable price limit. We could go out and pick up that game and maybe play it for, you know, 15 or 30 minutes and talk about it. And like people could like really, you know, recommend stuff that we might otherwise never play, you know, or have never even heard of maybe, but, it'd be a way to kind of like cultivate the content on the show in a way that's normally maybe not, we're not as willing to go out and find this really obscure thing and I think it'd be fun.
Well,
also
we'll have to find four copies too.
No. We deal. Yeah, exactly. So we'd all be together. So we'd only have to have one copy, But you know, we could record that, or we could do a live stream of that, and it would be, you know, creating special content. Of course, everybody would have access to it, but it would give some people a way to kind of influence that content. So those are just, it's a list of ideas. I'm not saying we're going to do any of that stuff. Certainly we're not going to do all of it, but those are just kind of some directions that I was kind of looking at. And again, I mean, the episode that we ultimately create, regardless of whether we do fundraising or how much we raise or where we do it or how we do it, it will be available for everybody. So this is not, you know, we're not asking people to pay for this podcast. I will never ask people to pay for the podcast. I think that goes against the whole idea of this. It goes against
the title of the podcast.
It's free. You know, I mean, it's the rebel thing. I mean, we are volunteers. We are, we're freelancers. We do what we want, and we make stuff, for ourselves, and we make stuff for the people who listen to the show, and, other people may or may not like it, probably won't. And that's okay. You know? So we do our own thing, and that's kind of the spirit that I'm trying to maintain when I think about doing all this stuff. But, anyway, I want to throw it out there. Obviously the reason I'm bringing it up now is because some of this stuff would take, a lot of planning, a lot of, you know, forward thought, and some of it would need to get started pretty soon in terms of at least doing the research, at least trying to find the dates, booking travel, things like that. So, I wanted to throw it out there, let you guys stew on it. You don't have to answer to all of this right now. But also, you know, hear back from the listeners and hear what they think. I mean, obviously this is a fairly ambitious plan. It's pretty different than anything we've ever done before. And that was my goal. I kind of thought about like, what is something that we've never done? And maybe what is something we've never done just because it was outside the realm of possibility, you know, because we didn't have the resources to do it. And to me, this is an idea that is almost the polar opposite of the way that we normally make the show. And that's what's exciting about it. And yet I think there's a lot of ways in which we can ensure that it maintains the spirit and that ultimately it is very much, Radio Free Nintendo. And you know, that's exciting for me. But like I said, if none of this works out, we will still, at the very least, we will jump on Skype and we will record for a couple hours and we will do, the best episode that we possibly can, even if we never raise a dime, we never travel, you know, we don't hear back from any of our friends who would like to contribute. So, if nothing else, we will get together and do something really cool, regardless. So I want to give people that assurance, because I'm not trying to scam anybody, and I'm not trying to hold the show hostage. No. It's not about that.
I'm buying this for research.
Indiegogo, meet a Best Buy and give me an HDTV. That's what I'm saying.
Look, how are we going to do 400 more episodes if I can't play Match of the Millennium exactly as it was intended by its designers? With a giant-ass cartridge the size of a phone book.
You're the worst.
Thank you. Look, I'm not asking for a CDI here, people.
Merely a Neo Geo Gold.
No, not a gold. Get that shit out of here. I want an AES console. Let's do this right.
All right. So we have filled up a couple hours here, as we do every week, and you know, hopefully the last bit there wasn't a turnoff or anything, but I'm excited by these ideas, and I would love to hear more. My heart is not set on this path, and I'm willing to listen to any ideas that people have, and we'll continue to discuss among ourselves. But you know, like I said, if we're gonna do stuff on this scale that I talked about, we need to get started on it pretty soon. So that's why I brought it up now. You know, we still got a lot of time, so I'm excited to see where it goes, and I'm very, very excited to be celebrating such a insane milestone with you guys, because I think, you know, what we've put together is very special. And the fact that we've kept it going for this long is not just a chest beating moment. It really speaks a lot to the support that we have from our audience, because they drive a lot of the content that we have on the show, and their encouragement keeps us going. I mean, we wouldn't do a show for this long if people didn't care about it, if people didn't, get back to us and interact with us and tell us that they appreciate it. So,
yeah, I mean, and the cool thing is too, people are still finding us, right? Even after so many years, people are still like, holy crap, I didn't even know about this podcast. So
in the middle of my rant at Eurocom, I just snapped a random picture of Ogabot 64 and said, well, at least the things that still matter work on my Wii. And somebody asked if we'd ever talked about it on the show. I'm like, yes.
Boy,
yes,
we
have talked about that game on
How
the
many
show.
Years ago did we talk about that on the show? That's the question.
It was 238, so it'd be at least 2 years ago. Maybe,
more
almost
than that.
Three.
Went, yeah.
And I'm like, I spoke a lot about that game on the show.
Yeah, so,
let me help you out.
Yeah, if you're not already aware, James is probably one of the world's biggest fans, I would say, of Ogre Battle 64, and is truly an expert. And as I said back then, I don't even like that game that much, but I love listening to James talk about it because he understands it on a level that I think very few people do.
And it's pointless. just it's pointless. It's the only word
to describe
it.
It's an acknowledged waste of his time, but so be it.
I may or may not have played that for an hour last night after Bond decided
not to. You've beaten it, what, 12 times?
Maybe.
12 times that he will admit.
It takes me half as long to beat it now as it did the first time.
I just remember the figure 12.
I highly recommend you go back and listen to those retroactive episodes. And in fact, listen to all previous 379 plus,
which some people
plus
do,
a
which
few
is
dozen
terrible.
Special episodes of this podcast.
So we did the math one time and calculated like you could listen to us talk for like
a month.
Like it was, I want to say it was at 2 months at this point.
Like unbroken, like if you never slept or
yeah,
took a break ever.
So basically right now there's a black site where someone is doing that to a prisoner. But
yeah, instead of heavy metal, it's RFM.
The CIA is our number one fan.
All right, guys. Well, we're going to have to wrap up this show. We will be back next week with GoldenEye. We're going to do a new retroactive. By the way, 30 retroactives? How is that even possible?
Wow.
That we've done 30 of these?
The NeoGAF thread has the list, which is how I found the episodes to tell them which ones they were. And I was shocked at how low a number it was. And then I was stunned by how many retroactives are listed there. And they're missing one.
Oh, really?
They're missing the most recent.
Jeez.
That's terrifying.
If you asked me to like write down on a sheet of paper all the retroactive games we've done, I bet I wouldn't get more than 10.
Yeah, that's what I would say, probably around 10 or something like that.
I might get 10. I mean, it's absurd.
It is one of my favorite features to do because it involves the listeners so much. And in this case, with GoldenEye, we're actually playing the game with our listeners. And I hope to do a lot more of that over the next week. So we're going to be setting up a couple, I think, official events. One of them will probably be before this episode drops, but we're going to do another one after this episode is published early next week. So if you're listening to this and the episode's still relatively fresh, please go check NintendoWorldReport.com because we'll have the details up
it's
there.
It's April 24th, by the way, if you're curious what fresh means.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm going to try to get I'm going to work with Neil. We're going to get an announcement up on the front page of the website. We'll get an image for it. We're going to try to make it easier for people to find this because I know a lot of people have this game. It was a very popular title on Wii. The online mode's really good. And this is one of your last chances to play that game online. So it's going away very, very soon. And it's worth talking about. So let's get together.
Less than 1 month.
Let's play it. And we'll reconvene in a week and talk about it. And I think there's going to be a lot to talk about. So I hope you will join us. If not, I hope you'll enjoy the discussion that comes out of it. But either way, you can also send emails about any other game, anything other than GoldenEye. You can send an email to us at rfn at NintendoWorldReport.com. There's also a link in the show notes, as always. I try to make it really easy for people to get a hold of us. But we would love to hear from you. We've gotten some really good emails lately, and It'll be a couple more weeks before we can start to catch up on those, but please, please do email us. We'd love to hear from you, and obviously it makes up a big part of the show. And finally, before we go, I want to let people know there is a new episode of Radio Trivia. It doesn't come out that often. It's kind of a sporadic podcast by design. So I try to let people know when one comes out because I know people may not keep up with it on a regular basis. And it's a really good one. You know, our friend Michael Cole hosts that one, and they play video game music. So if you've never tried it, I would highly recommend it. It is such a fun podcast. All of us have been on it multiple times. We all love it. And everybody who listens to that show loves it because they play really great video game music, and they turn it into a fun game with no stakes. It's all for fun, not for prizes. And it has discussion about those games too. And you always – for me, it's fun to go listen to it because they always end up playing music from games that I've never even heard of, and I learn a lot about it.
And sometimes we've never heard of on the show, too.
Yeah, exactly. So go check that out, too. We'll have a link to that as well in the show notes. And if you've never listened to Radio Trivia, I know it's not the most descriptive title, maybe, of a podcast, but it is one of my favorite shows, and it's been going on for almost as long as this one. They don't have nearly as many episodes, but that show's been around for a very long time, and it's fantastic. So go check that out, please, and come back next week. We'll have more Radio Free Nintendo
for you. And this is Steven's on it, right?
Yeah, that's Wendy Man, our old friend Wendy Man. He's been on this show a long time ago.
Former site director.
That's
Thank
right.
You.
My hand-picked successor. And Wendy, it's been a long time since we had him on a show, had him involved with the website. It's really good to hear his voice. And Wendy knows Radio Trivia very well, so he's a very, very good co-host. Go check that out. Anyway, while you're listening to that, we'll be making more of this, and we'll see you next time here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye.
Later.